Here's a little social interaction life hack I've discovered. If you're meeting someone new and you want to get to know them better, and you see any semblance of a tattoo peeking out of their sleeve, compliment it. If that person doesn't want to talk about their tattoos, they'll say, "Oh, thank you. Anyway, this is my stop." But if they do want to talk about their tattoos, their face will light up and then they'll do the rest of the talking. I realize that by giving you this advice, now anytime I compliment someone else's tattoos, it will seem disingenuous, but it's not, most of the time. I love all of your tattoos. That's right, I'm talking to you. I love your tattoos, dude. Whether it's how you got the tattoo, the meaning behind the tattoo, or being a tattoo of something you like, every tattoo is a story, and most people love telling stories about themselves. I wouldn't know anything about that, personally. I never understood why some people liked talking about their tattoos until I got one of my own. What, you think I'm gonna make a whole video about tattoos when I didn't even have any? That's right, I'm a marked man, Mom. What are you gonna do about it? Stop unconditionally loving me? Yeah, right. Wait, what are you doing with that cheese grater? Okay, but in all seriousness, can you make sure Grandma doesn't see this video, Mom? I don't want to upset her on the way out. Back in the day, tattoos used to be a symbol of rebellion and meant you couldn't get a job. No regrets, baby! But I feel like tattoos are getting more and more accepted, if not expected. I'll see a jacked, bald guy covered in tattoos and think, okay, yeah, he was meant to look like that. For me, the idea of being a badass tattooed guy with a sketch pad and a beanie and ripped jeans and a beaded bracelet always seemed cool to me. But like most people, when it came to tattoos, I had reservations. Ooh, this is gonna be on my body forever? What if I hate it? I had an idea once of getting these 5 Magic the Gathering symbols tattooed on my forearm. I even dotted them out in Sharpie once just to give them a test drive. But I ultimately decided not to get them because I was worried in 5 years I would go, "Oh, these? I was really into Magic the Gathering in my 20s. Not anymore, though, so now every morning I wake up with impending feelings of shame and remorse that I even decided to get this thing. And I didn't want that to happen, even though I've been playing Magic for over 15 years, and it means a lot to me, and I'm going to be buried with my Sliver deck, and alright, maybe I should just get it. Even though people know that tattoos are permanent, there are still way more bad tattoos than there should be. One time, I saw this picture of someone's tattoo on a bad tattoo subreddit, and I thought it'd be funny to prank my family group chat by photoshopping that tattoo onto my arm. And then I thought it'd be funny to post that picture onto Instagram. I didn't think anyone would fall for this poor excuse of a Photoshop job, but then the internet and my family proved me wrong. Immediately, I started getting phone calls from my parents, and even my book agent rang me up and was like, "Did you actually get that tattoo?" "No, it's not a real tattoo." I mean, it is a real tattoo, but it's on someone else's body. That's their cross to bear. I can only imagine what that person's family and book agent went through. My parents were not supportive of me getting tattoos. But whose are, am I right? Some people, like my parents, say that your body is like a temple, and getting tattoos is like putting graffiti on it. Which, sure. Okay, that's why I paid a professional graffiti artist to paint my temple exactly how I wanted. Also, you can't tell me not to deform my body when that's exactly what you did before I was even 24 hours old. Also, Jesus had piercings, and he loves showing them off to his buddies, so I think he'd be chill with a little tattoo. After much thought and deliberation, I finally settled on what my first tattoo would be. This was going to be permanently inked onto my body for the rest of my life. I got a tattoo in Courier New. Luckily, the artist was able to finish this in one session. It took quite a while, almost 5 whole minutes. Now, let me explain why I got it. It was so that if anyone ever asked me, "Do you have any tattoos?" I could go, "Why, yes, I do," and then roll up my sleeve, and then I'd go, "Ha, ha, ha." When I showed off my tattoo on Jaden's Streamathon, there was one comment that said, "James having tattoo actually tattooed onto him is exactly the kind of tattoo I expected James to have." And that made me feel really good because that meant the tattoo fit my vibe. And the second reason I got the tattoo was because I wanted to rebel. Since tattoos were frowned upon growing up, I wanted to have one just to have one. So I got a tattoo with no meaning whatsoever, which, in a way, is the meaning. Even though the tattoo was small and usually covered up by my sleeve, I still felt anxious about getting it. And I continued to feel that way for about a week after I got it. It was a jump scare every time I saw it in the mirror, and I would look at it closely and go, "Yep, that's really in there. I sure hope I don't regret this." But then, after some time, the tattoo just became a part of me. Like, I didn't look in the mirror and go, "Yep, there's James and tattoo." I would go, "Yep, there's James. Full stop." And from that day on, I loved giving people advice on tattoos. As a marked man myself, I think you should absolutely get that Shadow the Hedgehog full back piece. YOLO, remember? What? You're worried that it's going to look bad when you're 70? Yeah, it's going to look bad when you're 70. You're 70. Don't think about how bad it's going to look. Think about how much you're going to enjoy it from now to when you're 69. I've known people my age who still hide their tattoos from their parents, but like the honest prodigal son that I am, I wasn't going to be doing that. But the next time I visited my parents, I walked into their house, and the very first thing my mom said to me was, "Do you have any tattoos?" She beat me to the punch. What? Why would you ask that? "Because last night, I had a dream that you came home and were covered in tattoos. So, which one of you incepted my mom?" "God?" I said, "Are all tattoos bad?" "Yes, all of them are bad. Even this one?" And I rolled up my sleeve and revealed my massive tat. And her reaction was, "Ah." Oh. Well, it's not the worst word to have permanently inked on your body. Later on, she said, "If you go to a Star Wars party, you could change it to Tatooine." So, I think she took it pretty goodly. Now, some of you might be thinking that my epic sleeve of a tattoo isn't that big a deal. It's tiny and can only be seen if I'm swimming or boxing or wearing a tank top. But you see, after getting tattooed, I experienced what people in the tattooing business call catching the bug. After seeing how much I liked my first tattoo and knowing that I could handle having a tattoo, I was ready to get something badass. I set up a big boy tattoo appointment with an artist I liked, and when I was in the tattoo shop, the artist asked, "Is this your first tattoo?" "Is this my first tattoo?" No, sweetheart. I think I know a thing or two about tattoos. So, without further ado, I would like to debut this out of the blue tattoo. You know, from The Dark Crystal, the Jim Henson 80s puppet movie that I did a video on it years ago. Now I have the best character permanently inked onto my skin forever and ever. That movie will always hold a special place in my heart, and now it'll hold a special place under my skin. And now, whenever I show someone The Chamberlain, we end up talking about The Dark Crystal, which is great, because that's what I wanted to talk about anyways. I think I just discovered an autistic conversational cheat code. When I was getting it done, the artist asked me if there were any other tattoos that I wanted to get, and I said, "Why, yes, I do. I wanted to get the computer from Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared, because I also love that series, and because I'm a computery guy." And I didn't realize until as I was explaining it to the artist that both of these characters are puppets. So I don't know what that says about my psyche. I never thought that I liked puppets that much, but if anyone wants to psychoanalyze me in the comments, that'd be great. And speaking of YouTube comments, I know a lot of people are going to bring this up, so I'm just going to address it right now. You probably noticed that Chamberlain isn't holding his iconic triangle scepter. Yeah, I already know that. That's because he's holding the Emperor's scepter. It's like my own little headcanon. He got to be the Emperor because he's cool and awesome. And come on, Dark Crystal fans. You think I don't know my lore? I didn't get the wrong scepter or anything. You think I'd get something wrong about the Dark Crystal? Okay, you want to know what happened? I own a Chamberlain statue because, of course, I do. And I took pictures of it to send as a reference image to the artist. And I totally forgot that I accidentally broke off his triangle scepter. And now, because of that, he's holding an entirely different scepter on the tattoo. But you know what? I don't care. This one's better. It's a more clear silhouette. Now, this time when I went to show my parents the tattoo, I don't know exactly what I was hoping for, but I wanted to see some dramatic pearl clutching. You know, just some real disappointment. Chamberlain had to be split up into two sessions, and I only got one done when I went to Arizona for a wedding. I saw my mom, and she didn't immediately ask me if I had any more tattoos. God didn't tattle on me this time. I told her, "Mom, I gotta tell you something, privately." "What is it?" "I need you to keep a secret from Grandma." "Okay." "I'm serious. Grandma can't find out about this." "Okay." "Look, it's Chamberlain." And I showed her the unfinished tattoo, and she went, "Oh, do you even like the Dark Crystal that much? I mean, yeah, the plot's kind of mid, but it's a cool world. Why were you more upset about my fake Baby Yoda tattoo than my real Dark Crystal tattoo?" She didn't care, and neither did my dad. And you know what? I actually showed my grandma too, and she liked it. I can't make these people mad, no matter what I do. One of my cousins is a tattoo artist, and I was talking to him about tattoos, and my mom said, "Oh, you should get your cousin to finish it." And even he said, "Do not do that." Speaking of tattoo advice, if you're thinking about getting a tattoo, I think you should wait. Obviously, it's your body, your choice, but with the minimum age of tattoos being 18, and in some states 16 with parents' permission, I just can't imagine being happy with any tattoos 16-year-old James could think of. All I'm saying is that I'm glad I waited and gave myself time to really know if this is what I wanted. And it was. I know you're young and you want to look as hardcore as possible, but you can still get a tattoo when you're like 23 and it'll look good. Trust me. No matter what tattoo you get, it's a way to express outwardly to the world what you like, what you want to remember, and who you are. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm about to get a full back piece of my grandma's face. There's literally no way my family wouldn't love that. Thank you all for watching this YouTube video, and now that you're all done, I'm excited to announce that I have a Funko Pop of me! If that's something you're interested in, then you can head on over to my website and you can get a signed Funko while supplies last. As always, thank you to my amazing team, and the next time I'll see you, I might have more tattoos, who knows?
Hey, just a heads up, don't get too attached to any of the hamsters mentioned in this video. Because they're all dead. And I would say that no hamsters were harmed in the making of this video. Well, I mean, no hamsters were harmed while I made this video. They're all still dead. But some hamsters, they got harmed. Just keep watching. If there's anything I've learned that the internet just loves is stupid drama and cute animals. So I'm going to talk about all the cute hamsters that I've enslaved. Our family enslaved quite a lot. It was my twin sister who really wanted a pet hamster and bugged my mom to get one. And my mom, being super nice, bought her the cage, and we bought everything else, including a little black hamster. We named him Squeaks. And he liked to do this really cute thing where he put all of his food in his hamster wheel, and it was made of plastic so he could do that. And then late at night, he would just run in it, and it would sound like... It was like a more annoying maraca. I actually made a comic on paper inspired by this hamster. "Wow, you got a hamster?" "Yeah, but he doesn't do much." "Well, yeah, this type of hamster is nocturnal." "Really? That means I'll hardly notice him." And then at night, he's trying to sleep, but the hamster is loud, and that's keeping him awake. And the joke is that he said he'd hardly notice him, and he's noticing him. It's not that funny. And I need to tell you about a dog that we have named Georgie. And actually, a little fun fact about Georgie. She was born on Election Day of 2004, which is a much cooler holiday to have a birthday on. It only comes once every 4 years. It's like leap year. It's more rare. So since George W. Bush won the 2004 election, we named our dog Georgie after him. Aww. And that also means that her 12th birthday was on the 2nd. I definitely won't be able to get this video out by that time, but still.
Happy birthday to you. Yay! So Georgie can get the birthday, because it's her birthday, and Poppy can get the girl, because she's a girl. Do you like it?
I wonder if this tastes good.
Oh.
This is a huge waste of money.
Anyway, back to rodents. This dog just loved to murder these animals. Well, I don't know if murder's the right word. No, murder's the right word. You have to understand that Georgie is a West Highland Terrier, and that breed is known for hunting small animals. So having Georgie and a hamster in the same house doesn't mix well. We had this little plastic hamster ball that we put Squeaks in sometimes. The first time we put Squeaks into his plastic ball, my older brother bowled him. like a bowling ball. PETA, don't sue me. I was vegan for a week. And Georgie thought it was a treat just for her. A treat with a hard outer shell and a juicy middle. She would go straight up rabid wolf on that hamster ball. We didn't put Squeaks inside his hamster ball anymore after that. But there's even more to say about this hamster. One day, me and my sister came home from school and Squeaks was just gone. He escaped. Everyone, check your pockets! We looked everywhere and we couldn't find him. We had to keep a close eye on Georgie at all times. My sister put up missing posters around the house. I don't know if those helped. We made these traps out of Duplo. Did anyone else's parents get them Duplo instead of Legos? No, only my parents were that lame. Alright. We built this box thing out of Duplo, and we made these stairs going up to the top of the box, and we put lettuce on each step, and the plan was that the hamster would walk up the stairs and fall in the box, cause they're stupid. But the traps never worked. And all the hamsters we got in the future that also escaped, we made the same traps, and not once did they ever work. 4 days. Squeaks was missing for 4 days. We found his body inside the wall. He was alive! My dad was sitting on the couch relaxing. It was dead quiet, and he just heard the faintest... Squeaks was inside the wall! We think he got in through our laundry chute. I don't know what I would do if my kid's hamster was inside the wall of my house. Well, kids, now's an important time I teach you about death. My dad ended up cutting 3 holes in the wall and lured Squeaks out with some lettuce. Poor thing, he was probably starving. Hopefully he kept some extra food in his cheeks. So even being tormented by the dog and getting stuck in the wall for 4 days, Squeaks still lived a fulfilling 2 years of life. Hamsters don't have that long a lifespan. We buried him in the backyard. After the Squeaks dynasty, we got some more hamsters. Squeaks 2, that was the next one. We thought maybe if we introduced Squeaks 2 to Georgie, then they could be friends and get along. I'll spare you the details of what happened that night. The next one we named Killer because he kept biting us, so get it? Killer? Yeah, he ended up getting killed. Nah, I'm just kidding. He wasn't killed. He lived a long and normal hamster life. Squeaks 2 was killed, though. I don't know if you picked up on that. We bought these 3 little hamsters. Seriously, they're the most adorable little things. They look like this. I forgot their names. We'll just call them the 3 amigos. Aw. The lady at the pet store told us that if we bought hamsters from the same litter, they would all get along. She was obviously just trying to sell us more hamsters. Or maybe she didn't have any siblings. But these bros just hated each other. They would never stop fighting. As I was writing the script for this, I thought, well, maybe they were just aggressively playing. So I googled, do hamsters play with each other, just to be sure, and the first thing that showed up, dwarf hamsters, which is what the 3 amigos were, are quite territorial and will not see former cage mates as old friends. They see them as threatening rivals. So there we go, you really know your hamsters, lady. So we had to get 3 different cages for them. We put them right next to each other, and I swear they still gave each other some death glares. I actually made a video a long time ago about this time I broke one of their cages. I was cleaning it outside, and for whatever reason, I was like, huh, I wonder if I could stand on it. The answer, no, I couldn't. The glass broke and I bled everywhere, and I still have the scar on my foot. And then all the 3 amigos died off, one by one. Sorry, I'm getting really emotional. We also had this other hamster named Buddy, and I wasn't going to mention him because he just escaped and we never found him. Except as my mom was reading over the script, because she reads over my scripts, thanks mom, she turned to me and said, did we ever tell you what happened to Buddy? And I said, what do you mean? She said, you know how we couldn't find him? Well, we did, but the dog got to him first. This one time I wanted to buy a hamster and I saw some that were on sale, and there was this piece of paper next to the cage that said, please adopt us. Oh shoot, I'll take one of these puppies. No, not an actual puppy. I meant one of the hamsters. And I named her Pumpkin Seed because she was that tan pumpkin seed color. But then 1 month after I got her, she just died for no reason, even though I loved her. She had food, she had water. This wasn't the first time I was taking care of a hamster, okay? All the other ones lived for a couple of years. I was so sad. I totally got chipped. No wonder they were on sale. They were all halfway to death's door. I mean, I only had the hamster for a month. I didn't get that emotionally attached to it. But then later, I got a different hamster that I paid full price for, and I named her Gumball. Unlike all the other hamsters that were technically my sister's, this hamster was all mine. And she didn't have anything traumatic happen to her. She had a good hamster life. I was pretty sad when Gumball died. We lavished these hamsters, okay? We loved them. At least my sister did. She cried when they died and made little gravestones for them. Our mom used to always say, there's no point in being a skinny hamster. She gave them a lot of treats, so much so that it got to the point that the hamster would come out looking for my mom just by the sound of her voice. All in all, there's about 7 dead hamsters buried in our backyard. Rip in peace, little bros. Everyone, shut up and look at this video. I love the internet. Gabe the dog is a rescue.
Aw. Side question. Do you think Arthur Schwallow, Nobel Prize winner and inventor of the laser in 1957, would enjoy playing a round of laser tag, something that he invented? Someone should tweet to him and see if we can get him to play laser tag. Oh wait, he's dead. He'd be 95 years old if he was still alive. Oh, Jose, can you see? Well, he's playing laser tag in the stars now. What if that's what shooting stars are? Okay, here's a story sort of relating to the side question. So one time, me and this group of friends went to a laser tag place. Arena? For someone's birthday party. I forgot how old we were, but we were around 15 years old. So not that old, but old enough to think we were old. I don't know if any of you guys have been to a laser tag place, but when you get there, you usually have to wait for the game inside to finish up before you can go and play. So the laser tag place has these arcade games for you to play while you're waiting. So me and my friends are playing games, and this group of four guys wearing all black come in. I'm talking black long sleeve shirts, black pants, they had black freaking gloves on. Three of them were wearing some sort of black hat and the other guy who wasn't already had black hair. They looked about 18, maybe 19 years old. So my first thought was, ha, look at these goths, what dweebs, pfft. But then I remembered that the laser tag arena was darkly lit. These guys weren't goths, they were wearing camouflage. Part of me was thinking, wow, these guys came prepared. But the other part of me was thinking, wow, these guys are even bigger dweebs. They came prepared to a laser tag fight. I don't know what these guys' names were, but for the sake of this video, we're going to call them all Hunter. Not because they have guns and they hunt people, but because I think only people with the name Hunter would do this. I don't know why I'm biased against the name Hunter, it's just one of those names. If someone named Hunter is watching, I'm not sorry. Before you go in and play laser tag, you all sit in this room and some employee tells you the rules of the game, and then at the end they make you repeat the rules to them. So they say, I will not run, jump, or climb. And then you say, I will not run, jump, or climb. But I remember while we were chanting the rules, the four guys were just staring off and not repeating anything. Guys, I think these four are planning on running, jumping, and or climbing. So we all start playing the game. This was the type of laser tag that you gotta make up a name for yourself, and it would tell you who shot who. And there were three teams. There was the red team, the yellow team, and either the blue or green team. I forgot the colors, it's not important. So, while we were playing, we were having fun, like any person playing laser tag would, and then I run into this group of people who are wearing strobe lights. I couldn't see their faces or anything in that direction, really, but I knew immediately who it was. Do you want to take a wild freaking guess who?
It was the Hunter!
It was the Hunters! So I got hit many times by them, and then I broke one of the rules. I ran away like anyone should when getting hit by light amplification by simulated emissions of radiation. I found one of my friends, and I said, did you see the guys with the strobe lights? And he said, yeah. And they gave me this scar! And he had a 12-inch scar on his face, and I'm just kidding, that didn't happen, it was lasers. So later in the game, I got to one of the high towers to get a good vantage point. I'm about to straight up snipe one of these dweebs! I waited for about 10 seconds when I saw a flashing light, followed by darkness, followed by another flashing light very quickly in the distance. And I just started spamming the trigger. I couldn't see any of their flashing lights that you're supposed to hit, so I was just aiming at a glowing ball. And then, I hit one of them. And I knew immediately it was them because... Remember how we got to name ourselves? Well, no one really took that seriously. We all came up with joke names like Butt Fart or Big Wiener or Shooty McShootface. I'm just kidding on that last one, that meme didn't exist back then. But the name that I chose was, are you ready for this? A Girl. Let me explain. When you got shot with a laser, it would say who shot you. So whenever I shot someone, it would say, a girl shot you. I mean, sure, it's sexist, but I thought it was the pinnacle of my comedy career. So, I don't know if any of you guys have been in this situation, but let me tell you, it is very hard to keep a straight face when halfway across a laser tag arena, an almost adult man screams with 100% seriousness, I'm gonna kill you, girl! That's how I knew I hit someone. It's when Hunter screamed that. So everything was pretty normal after that. I finished playing the game, and then when the game was over, I see the Hunters holding a wad of black electrical tape in their hands. I'm not saying they put black tape over their sensors so you couldn't see them, but they totally put black tape over their sensors so you couldn't see them. Luckily though, their team didn't win, so ha! I mean, neither did my team, but it's not important. But I mean, screw those guys! Can you imagine them in the car driving to the laser tag place? Hunter's driving and he looks over and says, Hunter, did you bring the strobe lights? Yeah, Hunter, I brought them. Hunter, you brought the tape, right? Yeah, it's right here, Hunter. Hey, Hunter, where's your hat? Hunter said he was going to bring me one. Oh, sorry, Hunter, I forgot. Here, Hunter, take my hat. My hair's already black. Thanks, Hunter, you're the best. Yeah, Hunter sucks. If your name was Hunter, you probably suck, too.
I almost lost a $1,000 scholarship because of plagiarism. Let's talk about that. Plagiarism. Adverb. The practice of taking someone else's work or ideas and passing them off as one's own. Just the word plagiarism sounds like a crime. Racism, sexism, and plagiarism. I'm not here to talk about people who repost my comics, JPEG'd, cut my name off, and have the audacity to put their own watermark on. Nah, not that kind of plagiarism. I'm gonna tell you about all the times that I plagiarized in school. And, okay, just off topic, I wanna address something publicly. I don't go looking through other people's comics and go, oh, this comic's funny, I'm gonna redraw it and pass it off as my own. No, I'm not about that life. But some of my comics have been very similar to other people's comics. I read a lot of comics, so it's possible I saw them and then repressed them in my memory and drew them again, or it's possible that it's all a coincidence and me and someone else just came up with the same idea. It happens all the time with other cartoonists, not just me. Again, I don't purposely take comic ideas and try and pass them off as my own. Whenever people point out that my comic is a lot like someone else's, I get really sad. So you guys should check out these other cartoonists, they're really good. Anyway, I just wanted to say that at the beginning of the video because I'm going to be telling you about times that I actually did plagiarize. But that was just in school, okay? I keep plagiarism off the internet. Isn't that right, Matthew? I cheated a bit in school. An occasional glance at my partner's desk, maybe jot down that important equation on my hand, nothing too big. I had a math class where we went to lunch in the middle of the class, and whenever we had tests, the teacher wouldn't split the test into two parts. Do you expect us not to exchange notes? The first time that I got caught cheating was in 9th grade. And if you stalk me and watch my old videos, you know that I went to a preparatory school my freshman year. And in preparatory school, the amount of work they gave you as kids was just stupid, so cut me some slack. In one class, we had to write an essay about something historical or something, and I chose to write about the Berlin Wall, specifically about people who escaped across the Berlin Wall. Now, I chose this topic because, I don't know if you know this, but there's a National Geographic documentary about this exact topic. So I didn't copy and paste anything into my essay, per se. It's just I told the exact same stories in the exact same order as the documentary, and okay, I might have wrote some things down word for word. But at least I didn't plagiarize it from Wikipedia, okay? So I didn't copy and paste anything until I had to write the conclusion of the essay. And I found this article talking about it, and the article said some things that would have been perfect in my essay, so Control-C, Control-V. I turned it in, I didn't think too much of it, but then when I got it back, the conclusion paragraph had been highlighted and a "see me" was written next to it. So I had gotten in trouble for plagiarizing the conclusion. Just the conclusion. Nothing else. To be honest, I'd kind of forgotten that I copied and pasted the conclusion. I thought he knew that I basically turned in a script of a documentary. The teacher, who we'll call Mr. Batman, it makes sense if you knew him, he took me outside of the classroom, he told me that it was bad that I plagiarized, and he called my parents that freaking snitch. My parents got mad at me too. He gave me a chance to rewrite the essay, and I remember just being so traumatized and stressed out that night, I kept thinking, what if he finds a documentary and sees that I practically plagiarized the whole essay? I ended up rewriting not only the conclusion, but the whole freaking essay. I turned in the new essay, and I don't think he ever found out that I copied the whole thing. Except, I did just admit it, and he watches my videos. Seriously, in April, he emailed me and asked if I was the same James that was in his class. He's the only teacher to ever reach out to me, and even after all those years, I still didn't tell him that I plagiarized the whole thing. So, hi, Mr. Batman. You can't change my grade now, can you? But that was a good experience for me to have. It taught me a valuable lesson, because I didn't plagiarize a single essay for the rest of high school. But then community college rolled around. I did community college for a bit because I couldn't afford university on a subway payroll. I took honors and AP classes in high school. I was a relatively good student, except I didn't take any of the AP tests. So when I went to community college, I had to take classes that were a step below the classes I took in high school. What a great way to spend my time! Senior year of English, we were writing essays analyzing poetry. Freshman year of college, we were writing movie reviews. And the teacher didn't even like me. She thought I was a slacker because I was never paying attention. I didn't take community college seriously, but it was so easy, I was still getting amazing grades. On the third semester of community college, I took a public speaking class. Now, I might be an introvert, but I don't have a problem with public speaking. That's part of my job now. I took the class because it would be an easy A, and I needed a communications credit for my major. I wanted to be a math teacher, and you may not have noticed, but they publicly speak all the time. So I take the class, I'm like the best person in the class, right? And for the final, we had to give a persuasive speech in front of everyone. Oh, and by the way, I didn't learn, like, any tricks to help with public speaking. The whole class was literally just us giving speeches to each other over and over. So 3 semesters of doing easy classes and wasting my time, my apathy meters were just off the charts. I didn't want to work too hard, so I chose to do my speech on why we should get rid of the penny. And I don't know if you know this, but there's this YouTube video made by CGP Grey that makes great arguments on why we Americans should get rid of the penny. Again, I didn't copy and paste anything per se, it's just the speech I gave had the exact same arguments in the exact same order as CGP Grey. Okay, it was pretty much a one-for-one recreation of his whole video. I'm sorry, I thought we were getting graded on public speaking, not writing original speeches. The teacher caught me, I guess she's a fan of CGP Grey, and gave me a zero on the final. So I ended up getting a D in the class, and that was the worst grade I got in community college. Part of me was like, whatever. I don't care. This next semester, though, I wanted to go to a real college. And still trying to be economical, I found that it was actually cheaper for me to go to an out-of-state school than to go in-state. At this school, they gave scholarships to out-of-state students who had high enough GPAs and enough credits. It would have saved me thousands of dollars. And I had family living in this state, so that was another reason why I wanted to go to that school. But here's the thing. Even with that D, I still had a high enough GPA to get the scholarship, but since I failed, it didn't count as a credit, so I ended up being one credit short for what was required. Plagiarizing was going to cost me thousands of dollars. My options were either stay home and do a one credit semester of community college, or beg the university to give me my scholarship anyway. During Christmas, my family visited the state the school was in, so me and my dad got the chance to go to the school and basically talk our way into getting the scholarship. We talked to 5 different people. Now that's public speaking. I had to use my persuasive talking skills that I would have learned. And all of them were telling us there's nothing we can do. But we were talking to one lady, she was telling us the same thing about not being able to do anything. She looked at my transcript. She said, "Oh, you failed public speaking." She looked at it for a bit. She typed something on her computer. She printed out a piece of paper and handed it to me saying, "It's okay, I'm not good at public speaking either." She thought I was bad at public speaking! She thought I failed because I was insecure or something and not because I did something wrong. Oh, I'm just terrible at speaking to the public. So really, there was something you could do. I got the scholarship because a lady wearing a lot of eyeshadow took pity on me. But I only ended up staying a semester and a half at that school because my YouTube kicked off, and now I'm doing that full time. But I'm still thankful I got the scholarship. I hope my public speaking teacher could see where I am now. I speak in front of millions of people for my job. I mean, I can't see them and I'm just reading everything off a script in my closet. And I didn't get punished for plagiarism. I didn't learn my lesson. And I didn't learn anything in your class. So I feel a bit obligated to talk about France. It was really fun, really. Okay, one thing though. Every meal is like super important in France. Except for breakfast for some reason. For lunch and dinner, everyone sat down together as a family and talked. But for breakfast, they were just like, "Here's a croissant! Okay, let's go." I mean, breakfast is only the most important meal of their day. And I was going to make a joke about how they have an entire aisle of cheese in the grocery store, but I realized back home we have an entire aisle for candy and ice cream. So whatever. We went to the Louvre, which was like, so amazing. They had really cool art by famous people. They had the famous statue with no arms. They had these really fancy rooms because apparently people used to live here. And probably the most famous painting in the world, the Mona Lisa. That room was super crowded. And right behind the Mona Lisa, there was this super tall painting that probably took 20 years to make. The picture frame was as wide as my body. But were people crowded around this one taking pictures? No. I don't even know what this one's called. The American school system has failed me yet again. And as someone who likes to draw, I thought it was really cool to look at the amazing color and details. Also, I took a bunch of pictures of butts. Look, this is the really famous no arm one. Look at her butt. So I had a good time, but afterwards we went to the Picasso Museum, Modern Art Museum, and this other one. I forgot its name. It was French. And it's kinda weird going into these places as someone who likes to draw cartoons. Oh, I like the colors, they're pretty neat, and oh, putting the face on the side of the head, that's an interesting design. But I kinda have to draw the line somewhere, Picasso. I mean, just look at this! Why is it framed? Someone framed this. And Picasso was a good artist. Shoot, he's better than me. So why did they draw this stuff to hang up? Would you call this his best work? It's not just Picasso. Look at the modern art museums. My favorite piece was the painting of a black ring. In fact, I loved it so much that I drew over it in my phone and probably spent more time in thought than the actual artist. I'm not saying the more real a painting looks, the more artsy it is. Wait, yes, I am. I mean, look at my drawings. No, seriously, look at them. Their heads are super round and they're so white they can't dance. If I entered an art contest against Leonardo da Vinci, he would win! Because his stuff took talent. It's not easy to draw something that looks exactly like it does in real life. But cartoons? They're easy. They're so easy. And I know I'm leaving out paintings with color schemes and forms. Now after seeing this, I've come up with something called the Keith Haring Principle to help people like me better understand modern art. In the late 70s, a man named Keith Haring drew graffiti in subway stations and had sort of a unique design. Whenever he started to draw graffiti, he never thought about what the finished product was going to be. He just drew whatever he felt like. He ended up making thousands of them, and people started to notice his unique characters. Soon he got more and more famous and popular. Now he's at the point where you can buy t-shirts and mugs of his drawings. And I think that's really cool. They're interesting designs, and I would wear them. Do they belong in a museum? No. Keith made thousands of these small, simple drawings. They're still art, but not art people should pay to see. They should pay to wear and drink out of it. And by the way, this stuff is in no way researched, so I'm talking completely out of my butt right now. But I think Picasso and the circle painting should be on t-shirts. Or kids' books. Or even webcomics. So people would say, hey, I like your shirt. Thanks. I like the design and would never frame it and hang it up on my wall.
If you're one of those kids that spends too much time on that darn computer machine, then conventions are a great place to get the recommended amount of human interaction with others who share a similar interest. Or at least, they were. You might have seen some conventions in the news recently, you know, the ones like VidCon, Comic-Con, and E3, but did you know there's conventions for all sorts of different things, like coin collecting, pens, and degenerates? The first convention I ever went to was in Arizona called Phoenix Comic-Con. I was 16 years old, and it, no exaggeration, changed my life. I had heard a lot about geek culture online, but Phoenix Comic-Con was the very first time I witnessed it in its fullest. I was a very sheltered kid. It was the first time I'd seen a brony and a furry and whatever this is in the wild. That changes a person. I was told that it was not cool to like geeky things, and as a 16-year-old, I tried really hard to make it seem like I didn't secretly like a bunch of geeky things. But people at Comic-Con just embraced nerd culture like they didn't care what people thought of them or something. Is that allowed? I guess when I was 16, I was hyper-desperate to receive everyone's approval. I was so hyper-desperate that while walking around my first convention, I was stressing out that I wasn't in cosplay. Oh, all these pop culture characters are judging me because I'm not wearing any makeup. To this day, I still haven't ever cosplayed, but it looks like a lot of fun. If I did cosplay, I would want to go as this quadrupedic horse. Also Spark from Pokemon Go. I went to one panel called How to Make Steampunk Weapons, but instead of teaching us how to weld real-life weapons powered by steam, the people on the panel taught us how to paint Nerf guns to make them look like they were powered by steam. And that was, no exaggeration, the most disappointing panel I've ever been to. There was also a panel for bronies, but I was too chicken to go. Did I mention that my grandfather, who I'm named after, got drafted into World War II when he was 18? He fought in a war so I could go to a comic convention and be too nervous to talk to bronies. What a different life we had. At most conventions, people in the expo hall will sell a lot of super cool unlicensed merchandise. Yeah, a lot of artists will sell prints and plushies and oven mitts with characters and titles they probably didn't get the license to sell, but if it's at a convention or on Etsy, then for some reason it's okay. I've always felt weird about buying that type of merch. On one hand, you shouldn't be allowed to make money off of someone else's intellectual property without the owner's consent. But on the other hand, look at this cool Bowser wallet, Bowser print, and Bowser bandana that I own. And this body pillow. It's a moral gray area because the people buying this type of merch are the hardcore fans. They know of the property these characters came from. They probably already own licensed merch of the character. The artist isn't claiming to have created the character either. It's a mutual understanding between buyer and seller that we both think Bowser is cool and we just want to buy as much merch as possible. You kind of have to take it on a case-by-case basis, but let me just say this to get it out there. You're not allowed to sell bootleg Dot One's Out merch. Phoenix Comic-Con actually had to change the name of their convention to Phoenix Fan Fusion because the people at the San Diego Comic-Con didn't like that Phoenix was stealing their name. So these conventions that don't care about stealing other people's copyright are forcing others to respect their copyright. Interesting. As some of you may know, since 2012, I have become a little more successful. And in 2019, I got invited to be a guest at Phoenix Fan Fusion, which is my home convention. The really crazy part is the convention put me in the celebrity line, like next to the people where you have to pay for photos and autographs. I didn't charge my fans for anything, so that made my line appear a lot longer than others. And my line was, no exaggeration, right next to Jeff Goldblum's line. I was gonna make eye contact with Jeff Goldblum! Jeff showed up for a couple hours on Saturday, and when he came out from backstage, everyone in his line and my line started wooing and clapping, and even I was like... Woo! And then Jeff took a look at my line, then looked at me, and then gave me a nod of approval, saying, not bad, kid. He didn't say it out loud, but I could tell he said it with his eyes. He also said that I looked kind of cute, so oh, thanks, Jeff. The first time I went to VidCon, that also, no exaggeration, changed my life. Again, it was the first time I met all these YouTubers that I've been watching for years, and okay, I'll admit, at first I was kind of fanboy-y, but I've gotten completely desensitized meeting other YouTubers and feel no joy anymore. When I meet another YouTuber, I say, oh, you make videos in your bedroom? Me too. People know that you're a bedwetter too, right? No? That's just me then. If you've ever given me something at a convention, then you'll be happy to know that I've kept everything I've ever been given. Unless you're the guy that gave me a plastic baggie full of water and other junk and called it a homemade snow globe. I used to collect snow globes, so it was a nice sentiment, but I didn't want to take it home with me and have it inevitably break and get all the important fan art wet, so I chucked it. And as I'm telling you this, there's some poor kid out there going, hey, he's talking about my snow globe. He threw it away? And now I feel bad, so...
Here, I'll mail this to you, and you can get a taste of your own medicine.
I don't know why this is such a popular question, but a lot of times people will ask me, what's the weirdest fan interaction you've ever had? I think they think that some of you are cringy. I never have an answer for them because all my fans are super nice. Yeah, someone gave me a bag of water, but that's not weird, that's nice! Okay, I have received fan mail from a prison, which is true, so I guess some of you aren't law-abiding citizens. Going to conventions and meeting fans and being on panels is a lot of fun, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't give you a lot of time to really experience the convention. Since 2017, when I would go to a convention, it would mean I was working. I still had a fun time, but I didn't really get to just relax with friends. That is, until I went to a convention last December called MFF, which stands for Midwest Fur Fest. Now, James, did you go to a furry convention? Well, I went with some friends to a furry convention so that I could actually enjoy a convention and not have to work. Although I still got recognized even though I was wearing a disguise. Furries are very touchy people, I've learned. Not touchy as in overly sensitive. Well, some probably are, but they're also literally touchy. Let me tell you where I'm at in my life right now. Last December, I was in an elevator full of furries and, if my grandpa could see me now, he would probably be frowning. Or smiling, I don't know, I don't judge. We were all crowded in, there was a moose breathing down my neck, and we stopped at a floor because more furries wanted to come in. So I backed up to make more room, but I backed up a little too close to the moose, and he grabbed my hips and I went, ah! In my mind, I didn't say it out loud. In real life, I went, So that was probably the weirdest fan experience I've had, if you were still wondering. I don't know if he was a fan of my YouTube, but he was definitely a fan of my body. Or he was drunk. I don't know. Again, I don't judge. I was debating on whether or not I should include this story, but I think it would be a good lesson for everyone to hear. Here's my James PSA. This message is for everyone, and especially furries. Don't touch people without their permission. In the moment, I stayed quiet, but that sort of behavior isn't okay and I should have spoken out. Hopefully, most of you are mindful of other people's personal space. However, comma, at least one of you went to prison, so... I don't know. Overall, it was the best ironic trip ever. At the end of the day, conventions are a lot of fun, and I really, really miss going to them. And when it's safe to do so again, I recommend you try and go to one you're interested in. And Grandpa, I'm sorry if I disappointed you.
So me and TJ had to sleep a whole night in the axe-smelling tent. Every breath I could taste the smell, and I just got more and more angry. The night finally passed, and I woke up early in the morning before everyone else, so I could start with my master revenge plan. Was I tired? Maybe.
but that's the sacrifice you have to make for vengeance.
Every campsite had a water fountain coming out of the ground, connected to a PVC pipe. I found the biggest Ziploc freezer bag I could find and started to fill it up with water. It was obviously a slow process. I had plenty of time to reconsider. To think about what TJ said or what would happen after I got my revenge. But nothing stopped me. I was a squeaky-voiced, hormone-induced monster. Once the bag was full, I went back to my tent and woke TJ up. He got up and I told him to watch this. TJ actually had no part in the revenge plan. I just wanted to suck him down with me. I think TJ actually didn't want to get revenge. I ran towards the mega log tent and hid behind a real tent that was right next to the log one. Everyone was still inside. TJ still had no clue what I was doing. Until I chucked the bag over the real tent. If everything went according to plan, the bag would break on the roof and the water would sink through the openings. And then they'd be super wet, LOL. That was the plan. I never saw the carnage my creation had done. I was worried that I'd completely miss the log tent. I never played any sports as a kid, so just making it over the first tent would have been an accomplishment. But the fact that everyone started screaming and one boy yelled, "Micah, I'm gonna kill you!" I knew it must have been the most perfect shot. Did I stay around and laugh at their stupid, guilty faces? No. Me and TJ ran away as fast as we possibly could, without looking back. We sprinted off into the woods before any 15-year-old saw us. We just kept running and running, making sure to get as far away from camp as possible. And on the way, I kinda threw up a little. TJ, being the good friend that he was, thought I was unfit to run, so he decided that we should hide in some bushes. After about 5 minutes, nobody came.
"Should we head back to camp?" "No." "Yeah, you're right."
So we kept running, until we found the lake where scouts could canoe in. Me and TJ both thought this was a good place to stop, so we sat by the lake and talked for a few hours. Because in a week, TJ and his family were going to move away to China for 2 years, and I knew I wouldn't see him again for a long time, so I wanted to spend every moment I had with him. We were just a couple of bros being real with each other, skipping rocks and talking about our feelings. And then that night, the 15-year-old's tent got axe-bombed. So I guess it wasn't them. Oh, and remember how I threw up after running so much? Well, apparently there was a sickness going around camp that all the camp instructors got, and about 50% of the scouts got it too. And lo and behold, one of the 15-year-olds wasn't feeling so well when he went to bed that night. And then the sudden jolt awake and the cold water made him throw up.
Yay!
I don't go outside that much. Ergo, I don't see people that much. Ergo, I don't get recognized in public that much. Now you might think, James, really? You get recognized? But you're just some college dropout sitting in the closet right now making cartoons on the internet. People recognize you and talk to you and ask for your autograph? Yeah, I thought the same thing. I don't even show my face that much in my videos, so I don't know how people remembered what I looked like. When I first started drawing comics 4 years ago, I was never expecting that later people would be coming up to me and nervously asking me to write my name down on a piece of paper. Now, can I just talk about this? I don't have a signature. And if I'm going to be signing things, I really should start thinking about getting one. I signed 6,000 cards, and on all of them I just wrote James and put a little smiley face. I probably wrote my name out more times that week than I did my entire life. Also, another thing, I have terrible handwriting. You'd think since I'm good at drawing cartoon characters, I should be good at drawing letters of the alphabet. Whenever I sign something, I always have to warn my fans, "I'm really sorry, I have bad handwriting." And they always say the same thing, "It's fine." No, it's not fine. I'm about to ruin whatever this pen touches. I don't get recognized nearly as many times as you might think. Like, I can go to the grocery store and not get recognized at all. Although, I am noticing that I get weird looks from kids now. I don't know if that's because of YouTube, though. But if you do see me out in the wild, then by all means, come up to me and say hi. Even if you're not sure it's me, still come up and ask. Even if I'm on my phone, just slap it out of my hand and I'll say, dude, what the heck? And then you say, the odd one's out, and I'll say, maybe. I'm a pretty chill guy, okay? The only time I can think of it not being okay to come up and talk to me is if I'm asleep. Don't wake me up, guys. One time I was at the dollar store, not a proud moment in my life, and later I went home and someone on Twitter asked, hey, were you just at the dollar store at this address? And I said, maybe. Another time I was at Chipotle, and I know in a previous video I said, hashtag boycott Chipotle because he didn't hire James like 3 years ago. But I'm a weak man. I might have to call off the boycott. So anyway, I'm standing in line to get a burrito, and I see a girl sitting down in the chairs looking at her phone, and she sort of looked like a girl that I went to high school with. Is that Rachel? I didn't say anything though. I got my food, and as I was about to leave, I glanced back at the girl, and she was looking at me. We both had that look in our eye like, yeah, we know each other. So I went over to her and I said, hi Rachel, are you James from The Odd Ones Out? You didn't go to high school with her. Okay, well I'm gonna go now. Good luck on your own. Yeah, I am. What's your name? Maria? My name's James. You already knew that. If you're watching, Maria, when I saw you, I thought we went to high school together. You look like someone who was on my improv team. So I recently went to PAX South with my friend Eugene. That's not his real name. I asked him if he was okay with me saying his real name in this video. He said he was fine with it, but I think calling him Eugene would be funnier. If you don't know what PAX is, it's basically Comic-Con, but only for games. They have card games and board games, but it's mostly video games. I've known Eugene for about a year now, but I've only ever talked to him over the internet. One day he asked, hey, do you want to go to PAX South with me? It's in my hometown. And I said, sure, because I think that's what friends do. I'm going to leave out a lot of details about what I did at PAX because I think that can be a video all by itself. But just traveling there, I was recognized. I got on the airplane to go to Texas and this girl and her mom sat next to me. And I noticed that the girl's iPad wallpaper is Markiplier and Jacksepticeye. Part of me wanted to say, oh, so you watch YouTube videos? Do you know me? But that's a tacky thing to say. I thought if she knew me, she'll say something. Don't start off conversations like that. We went the whole flight without saying anything to each other, and then when we landed, Mom said to me, hey, my daughter thinks you make YouTube videos. Maybe. On Friday, Eugene had to go to classes before PAX, so I went with him just so I could go straight to the convention. One of his classes was in a computer lab. I sat down next to Eugene's friend, and the computer was already logged on, so I was worried that I might be stealing someone else's spot. Then some other guy walks into class, and he looks at me and goes, whoa. And I said, oh, is this your spot? You're the odd ones out. Maybe. I didn't know him, but he knew me. Which is weird to think about. Of all the places you'd expect to meet a YouTuber, your computer lab wouldn't be one of them. I started messing around on Microsoft Paint. I wasn't paying attention to the teacher. I drew a landscape with a horse. It was beautiful. And then I drew my cartoon character with a mouse. Also, side note, this is why you don't draw with a mouse, kids. And Eugene's friend saw it and said, hey, that looks like a YouTuber my brother watches. And I said, huh. Weird. And then I went to PAX, I got recognized a lot there. I almost got kicked out because of all the people who recognized me were causing a fire hazard. After PAX was over, I went to the airport to go home. I got recognized by another kid who didn't even go to PAX, and also apparently another person recognized me and took this stalkerish photo and tweeted it to me. You could have said, hey, I was just playing on my DS. I wasn't doing anything important. And then while I was making this video, I got recognized again at Target. Not including VidCon, PAX, and the junior high that I tutor at sometimes, those were all the times that I got recognized. That I remember. At PAX, there is this boy who came up to me and said, you at the bed until you are 8 years old. He was bringing up a joke in the peeing video where I said if we ever meet each other in real life, you're not allowed to bring it up. But the kid was saying it obviously as a joke. I knew he was messing around with me, so I laughed and I pushed him away like, eh, get out of here, you knucklehead. But then later I was thinking, I probably pushed that kid a little too hard. I hope I didn't make a bad first impression. So, if I pushed you at PAX, I was doing it in a loving manner. In conclusion, if you see me out in public, don't be afraid to come up to me and say, hey James, you left your house. Good job. I'm a pretty normal person.
This brick is alive. Not convinced? Well, what if I did this?
I'm gonna do a backflip!
That's gonna look so cool, Brickathy!
What are you boys doing?
Brickathy's gonna do a backflip, Grandma!
Thank you.
Are you convinced now? Did the brick feel more alive? I mean, sure, it's still a brick that can't move on its own, but maybe because I put googly eyes on it and gave it a family, you can connect with this brick, and it made you feel emotions. Convincing you that something inanimate is animate is the main goal of the animate ore. They're nothing more than deranged frauds. For the last century, animators have innovated new techniques and styles to this medium, taking it from a spinning wheel that doesn't even use electricity to Spider-Verse. And today, I'm going to talk about all the processes and innovations that have brought the medium of animation to right now. But first, let's go all the way back to the beginning of film, when it was all black and white and people had to put up text whenever they talked. Early on, filmmakers discovered a very simple trick to make anything appear alive in front of a camera. And that simple trick was called... You're filming something, and then stop the camera, and then move the thing slightly, capture a new image, move the thing again, and continue to do that a tedious amount of times. On the film, that thing now magically looked like it move on its own. And with this technique, you could make literally anything appear to be moving. Anything. But some filmmakers took this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters out of clay and a posable metal wire system called an armature. Now animators can sculpt unique characters that bend and pose in much more believable ways. With stop motion, you don't need to hire a real dinosaur or giant monkey to make a movie about a dinosaur or giant monkey. I'm sorry you didn't get the job, Phil. You know, I just had a crazy idea. What if we made our entire puppet's head interchangeable? Now they can make any facial expression and mouth shape possible. We will have to sculpt out hundreds of different heads, though, but, I mean, come on, that'll be fun. That's why we're extreme, baby! Stop-motion movies are still being made and enjoyed to this day. And while new technology does help make the overall process easier, animators are still using the same techniques that were used on King Kong back in the 1920s, where they carefully pose out a character's every movement frame by frame. In order. Stop motion is a medium that I can't even begin to understand how they do, let alone make it look good, you know? Having a stop motion character in gravity-defying poses, making hundreds of different faces, is done solely to make the character feel more alive. And sometimes, to help sell the realism, animators will mimic quirks that only happen in live-action films. I always chuckle when I see a lens flare in an animated movie, because, like, where did you come from? There's not even a camera lens. Unlike me, though, who's always got a camera rolling. Hey, how's it going? Uh-oh. Oh, no! Did you catch that? Did you see the lizard eating a bug? Ooh, we got him. Now let's rewind the clip and pause right here. This lizard moves so fast that the camera can't even capture its movements correctly, and he transmogrifies into an amorphic blob that barely even resembles a lizard. But do not fret, dear viewer. This is called motion blur, and is absolutely natural. Fast-moving objects are hard to see in real life anyway, so this blurry blob only showing up for one frame actually helps sell the idea that this little guy is moving quickly. If you watch any movie frame by frame, you'll find motion blur everywhere, and you won't even notice. So how do animators who are taking hundreds of still photos handle this naturally occurring phenomenon with things in motion? Easy, they'll draw smear. Animators draw their own blurry blob frame to mimic fast movements. Bodies can stretch, arms can multiply. Basically, we can sneak in nightmares as long as it's only shown for one frame. Smears, while being very fun to draw, can look very weird and goofy on their own. But in the context of the whole shot, you barely even notice they're there. Okay, maybe now you'll notice them, but that's only because I pointed them out. And since animators are bad boys and don't play by the rules, they can make smears out of anything. Even in stop motion, we can sculpt a physical smear frame like how they did in Laika's Paranorman, which, if you haven't seen, is going to be your new favorite movie. Smear frames can be used anytime, anywhere. Unless you were an animator in the 1920s and 30s and you didn't know about them back then. In that case, you would have been animating something called... In the 1920s and 30s, animators were still figuring out some core principles of animation. turns out there's 12 of them. Smear frames were used sparingly during this time, with animators usually only drawing characters with multiple limbs to show fast movements. The stretchy, wacky, and spiritually ascending smears that you all know and love weren't really used until the 1940s. Rubber hose characters have noodly, almost hose-like limbs that bend in all sorts of anatomically defying ways. Look at Mickey Mouse's noodle arms that I can now legally show you. The reason characters look like this is because drawing noodle arms and not worrying about anatomy is easier to draw. But like, just because something has noodle arms doesn't mean it's bad, you guys. What these animators were able to accomplish with the technology, if you could even call it that, is nothing short of dark magic. And the very same studio that made Steamboat Willie wanted to push the envelope and show the world that animation could be more. It doesn't just have to be noodly characters with Pac-Man eyes. They were going to animate a realistic woman with proportional arms that don't move in weird, exaggerated ways. And oh god, her noodle arms are moving in weird, exaggerated ways. In 1934, Disney released a short called The Goddess of Spring, being their first attempt at animating a character with what was supposed to have real human anatomy. They still had a lot to learn, obviously. Now, animating a quote-unquote anatomically correct human is actually a much harder task than you might realize, and that's because of the uncanny valley. Get more and more human characteristics, we hit an interesting point right here when something looks almost like a human, but is just a little off. Our pattern recognition brains start setting off alarm bells and go, ugh, something is definitely wrong with that almost human. I am entering fight or flight right now. So if you're trying to make something look as close to a human as possible, but are just a tiny bit off, everything crumbles. The Goddess of Spring was still good practice for Disney because only 3 years later, they released the world's first fully animated feature film, Snow White. Can you really blame Disney for going 6 times over budget to make this movie? I mean, just look at how these human characters are moving. 10 years before Snow White, animated humans looked like this. So going from this to this in only 10 years? How? I can't get over how real these human characters look sometimes. Almost too real. Well, I think you're old enough to learn about the dangers of rotoscoping is the process of taking real-life footage and then manually tracing over every frame, resulting in an animation with unreal levels of realism. And I say unreal derogatorily. You're basically slapping a cartoon filter over live-action footage, but instead of simply slapping, you're spending multiple hours doing mindless and tedious drawing. Rotoscoping is not the same as filming a human actor and then later referencing that footage, like what Disney did for Sleeping Beauty or Alice in Wonderland or any movie ever, because animators use references all the time. People had figured out how to rotoscope other people long before Snow White. So of course Disney, who was trying to convey real human movement, rotoscoped some shots. The problem with rotoscoping is that we start to sneak our way back to the bottom of the uncanny valley. Animated characters often do and should break the laws of physics. They can squash and stretch into weird proportions and be drawn in unique and interesting poses. And look, Snow White is still a masterpiece of a movie. The rotoscoping is fine, you barely notice it. It's good, it's a good movie, and it made Disney a lot of money. Also, how did Walt animate these shots of things reflecting in the water in 1937? What, did they put special glass over paintings to make it look distorted or something? Who would be crazy enough to do that? If you made a whole movie entirely rotoscoped, what you end up with is Ralph Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings. Notice anything off about these characters' movements? Look at how Gandalf moved just a year ago in The Hobbit. Now, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit. Lord of the Rings. Almost every shot in this movie was rotoscoped, and the shots that weren't used live-action footage with a filter over it. I'm not saying that rotoscoping is bad. You just have to use it correctly. A character switching from traditionally animated to rotoscoped is incredibly funny, and always will be. The YouTuber Joel Havier makes very entertaining rotoscope skits that feel like a fever dream, and I mean that underogatorily. And a lot of music videos get away with rotoscoping because, admittedly, rotoscoping is a very cool visual. Now, I wish I could say the first Lord of the Rings movie was a hidden animation gem, but I don't know, it's not on my top 10, I'm sorry. It probably made a lot of nerds in the 70s happy, but thankfully The Lord of the Rings has been adapted into many other forms of media, like video games, Magic the Gathering cards, and anime.
Anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings anime?
They're making a Lord of the Rings.
You thought Hollywood, California was the only place in the world making moving pictures? Japan's been making their own moving pictures too, and some of them are moving drawings. There are entire college courses on the history of anime, but you're not paying me tuition, so we're gonna have to skip over a couple things. A lot of early anime is now lost media because cinemas didn't preserve film back then, and an earthquake destroyed many studios in 1923. Some Japanese animators created shorts out of paper cutouts because buying thousands of celluloid sheets was too expensive, and they had some very unique character designs. And some Japanese animators took inspiration from Disney and made shorts that looked very similar to America's rubber hose characters. Then, by the 1940s, some major world events happened that got most of the world involved, and both American and Japanese animation studios were affected. But after all that, in 1948, one studio called Japan Animated Films, later bought out by Toei Animation, set out to be the Disney of the East, and they made cartoons about magical schoolgirls, and are still in business to this day and made some other less popular shows. One animator who quit working at Toei created his own company and made an anime based off his comic about a robot boy. Hey, I kind of like that art style of drawing humans with big expressive eyes. Let's do more of that. That same year, another studio made an anime about humans controlling giant robots. I wonder if that's going to inspire a whole new genre. And this guy was commissioned by American studios to make stop-motion Christmas movies like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Meaning Rudolph is anime.
Nani?
By the 1960s, Japanese shows started airing on televisions all across the globe, and they continued to make unique and interesting stories with amazing animations that were beloved by billions of people and grew into extremely profitable franchises. Like, I'm talking the most profitable franchise. By the 1970s, Disney was still very much the animated movie gold standard, making big-budgeted movies with family-friendly values. Which is fine to do. Kids love bright colors and talking animals that only cartoons can offer. But some studios realized that animation was a medium, not a genre, and made animated movies exclusively for adults. That's part of the reason why the first Lord of the Rings movie was entirely rotoscoped. It wasn't trying to be cartoony and over the top. It was trying to be real and gritty. Animation could be anything for anyone of any age. But really, if you think about it, there hadn't been a new way of showing people moving drawings since those very early days of black and white stop motion. In stop motion, you take a picture, move a figure, take a picture, move a figure. In cell animation, you take a picture, move a cell, take a picture, move a cell. Everything's just been a series of pictures moved manually in front of a camera this whole time? Always has been.
You've got mail.
Oh. It says the entire animation and film industry is about to be flipped onto its head forever and ever. Yeah, right. I'm sure this whole computer thing is just... Ever-increasing advancements of technology, we were able to achieve increasingly advanced... achievements, like putting a guy on the moon, and drawing silly little cartoons more efficiently. Gone are the days of having to physically draw everything out on paper and underpay a team of hundreds of pretty girls to hand-paint every frame. Now we can use this fancy new computer to render everything out for us. All we have to do is create a real-life mold of our real-life human hand, then draw 350 triangles onto that hand, then manually measure out the X, Y, and Z coordinates of 800 different data points. No, come on, this is gonna be so much faster. Put that pencil down. Now we just program in a couple of keyframes and we get... Huh. We still don't have the processing power to render everything out. Oh, I know. We'll just point this long exposure camera at the computer screen. Get these art supplies out of here. This is the future. And when everything's finished rendering, we'll get this. A whole human hand moving on its own without having to draw a single frame. This process is exactly what Utah University student Ed Catmull did in 1972. And while it might not have been more efficient than drawing everything out by hand, it showed that computers were capable of rendering out three-dimensional animations. This was made after we landed a man on the moon, by the way, so don't tell me this was CGI. As the computer's processing power grew exponentially, more and more filmmakers started seeing the benefits of using computer-generated images in movies. A decade after Catmull digitized his hand, films like Tron showcased characters racing on mind-boggling computer-generated light cycles. This might look, you know, bad by today's standards, but these graphics were something that audiences had never seen before. Plus, the movie takes place inside of a computer, so this is probably what people thought the insides of a computer looked like anyways. At the time, computers did a great job at creating rigid, geometric shapes, and animators used that to their advantage. Characters would still have to be animated traditionally on cells, but objects that weren't going to change shape, like black cauldrons, could now magically fly in circles around our characters. Disney really showed off the computer's rendering power during the climax of The Great Mouse Detective, when these two rodents fought each other inside a clock tower and all the spinning gears were generated by a computer. Animators can now make any complex shape move in a three-dimensional space without having to draw a single frame. I mean, you know, except for the characters, they still very much had to draw those. Computer graphics were here to stay as Disney integrated more of them into movies like these cars in Oliver and Company or Eric's ship in The Little Mermaid, and then they stopped using cells entirely. Starting with The Rescuers Down Under, Disney no longer used cells and made movies entirely digitally with a program called CAPS. So if you ever wanted to own a cell of Joanna the Lizard eating an egg, that's too bad because they don't exist, which fucking sucks because Joanna was the best goddamn lizard Disney ever made. Don't touch me! TV shows and anime still use cells till about the year 2000-ish, but eventually everyone switched to digital. Now to color a frame, all you had to do was... So computers were great at making rigid, non-flexible shapes, but has anyone ever tried to make... A group of computer scientists who were working for a small indie director named George Lucas were taking this art form to an extreme level and created whole characters completely generated by a computer. Then a small entrepreneur named Steve Jobs hired those computer scientists and made his own company, Pixar. Yes, Steve Jobs was one of the founders of Pixar, and he originally created the company to sell a high-end computer powerful enough to render 3D animations. But no one bought the computer because it cost $135,000. So the team scrapped the computer selling idea and just stuck with making computer-generated cartoons. But they soon discovered a unique problem. The computer had a hard time getting textures right, and everything, including babies, ended up looking like it was made out of plastic. So the team's clever workaround this dilemma was to make a movie with the entire cast of characters actually made out of plastic. Or ants. You know, people don't know what ants are supposed to look like. It's fine. Pixar continued to develop new processes to get the computer to generate unique textures and lighting, like simulating human hair or fur, or lighting things in such a way to make everything appear underwater. No other studio was pioneering computer-generated images like Pixar was. And then in 2006, Disney bought Pixar. But I don't think Steve was too upset because 1 year later, he achieved his dream of selling a high-end computer. This time being a little more affordable. A little. Now, I want to squash any misconception that computers do all the animating. Animators still have to manually pose a character's body and facial expression off of a character's... build a complex system of nodes and bones that let them manually pose a character into any position possible. It's kind of like a digital stop-motion puppet, or an actual puppet without any of the strings. All CG characters are just their own complicated version of Pinocchio. Using character rigs is really the only way of animating things in three dimensions. But it's not like we can use rigs in 2D animation. Here in the second dimension, we don't have a fancy Z-axis. 2D animation can only be done by hand-drawing 24 new images every second. Except we don't, I lied. Even all the way back when characters were animated with paper and cells, animators wouldn't draw a whole new frame every frame. Usually, they would animate pieces of a character and paint each piece on its own cell. You remember Robin? They only drew one body and 5 different heads. But because cells are a physical object that get harder to handle the more you have, animators could only break a character up into 2 or 3 different pieces. But now, thanks to the computer, we can break up a character into as many pieces as we'd like. Like 4. Or 5. Or 173! Have you ever played around with the free and revolutionary animation software Pivot Stick Figure Animator? If you're the type of person that says, "Oh, I suck at drawing. I can't even draw stick figures," then you're gonna love this program. On Pivot, you're given a pre-made stick figure or horse that have these joints that can be posed however you like. Each of these stick figure's limbs are just individual pieces that are connected in such a way that make it look like a stick figure. So to make these animations, we're not really drawing anything, we're just manually posing out a character like a digital puppeteer. I wasn't saying you can make a rig out of 173 pieces just to be funny. Because that's how many pieces I'm made out of. That's right, me! Even I'm a rig! And can I tell you a secret? Most TV shows use rigs too. Of course, hand-drawn traditional animation is still used to make these shows. It's not a lost art form or anything. But rigs are super useful at making still pretty high-quality levels of animation, but at a much cheaper cost. And as we all know, TV animation has to create more animation per budget. But maybe rig animation still isn't as cost-effective as you'd like. And maybe you're not a fan of the complicated puppet look, and you want something that looks more human. Well, there's one more animation process we can try, called motion. Actor inside one of these dorky ping pong suits, a computer can pinpoint and record that actor's exact movements. Now we can take those movements, slap a cartoon character's model over it, and we get an animation that looks like shit. Motion capture is the rotoscoping of 3D animation. It cuts costs, but the results are too human, and we're back at the bottom of the uncanny valley. That's why the kids from the Polar Express look so nightmarish, because they are following the exact movements of Tom Hanks. Yes, Tom Hanks, the adult man, did some motion capture for the small, nameless hero boy from the Polar Express. There's probably a reason we haven't made a fully motion capture cartoon in over 10 years. Because it looks weird. But I mean, that didn't stop one of these movies from winning an Oscar in animation. And before you ask, no, it wasn't Monster House or Tintin. It was Mars Needs Moms, duh. Just like rotoscoping, motion capture can be used correctly. Computer-generated characters acting side-by-side real human actors look decent. It's not that jarring that these creatures who exist in a live-action world are moving just like live-action people. And let's not forget all the VTubers who use motion capture technology to bring their jiggly assets to life. No matter what method someone uses to try and convince you that something else is alive, I think is incredibly cool, and I hope you think it's cool too. But maybe you don't think it's cool, and you don't care about animation, and you just put this video on in the background while you were cleaning. That's totally fine, I do that all the time. I just like learning about how all my favorite animated pieces of media get created, because it's not always the same process. And I think it's great that new technology is allowing anyone to express themselves in whatever way possible. A person expressing themselves. Those are the 3 key words here. From the big studios that are just now pioneering new and interesting styles with digital animation, to the indie studios that have access to incredible technology which allow anyone working from their bedrooms in their pajamas to create some truly masterpieces of animation. So, if you're the type of person that likes to trick people into thinking that something is alive, then you deserve all the respect in the world. In fact, here are some cool people that made the animation in this video possible. Hello, you just made it to the end of this video. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm still trying to figure out this VTuber model, so I'm over-enunciating my words. The technology behind this is beyond my comprehension. If you're still deciding what to get for the holidays, then great news. We have mystery boxes over on my website, so you can leave the deciding up to us. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm gonna go take a nap. Are you still watching? Oh yeah, she's coming back.
Do you all remember that classic kids movie made in the 70s about a pig and a spider?
Yeah, Charlotte's Web?
Remember how it made us a lot of money? I mean, remember how it ended on a cliffhanger?
What was he talking about?
I didn't think it was a cliffhanger. Yeah! Big cliffhanger! It's been 30 years! Everyone wants to know what happened to that spider! The spider died, Ethan. Oh, I didn't watch it. But you got one thing right. Everyone is wondering what happened next. The first movie wasn't satisfying enough. America needs a sequel. Who would watch that? And then 3 years later, we can make a live-action version! Now you're speaking my language, Ethan. Everyone else, you're fired! For some reason, movie producers and showrunners think that kids are stupid and don't know what good content is. They probably think that as long as a kid's show is a cartoon and it's moving, they'll love it. Well, here's the truth, Hollywood. The cartoons don't have to move, but you do need to write likable characters in a plot that actually makes sense. The only people who know what kids like these days are YouTubers. Am I right, fellow youths? Hashtag let Pokemon go to the polls! I thought I had pretty low standards as a kid, but sometimes I'd be watching a show and even I'd think, this is weird. Why does this need to exist? Why are the animals singing? One of my favorite shows growing up was Yu-Gi-Oh! Anyway, because I'm an adult, I bought and framed 3 Yu-Gi-Oh! Cards.
And dang it, these cards are too small to even fit in the frame.
I don't even know why I liked Yu-Gi-Oh! So much. It was basically just anime characters playing the exact same card game over and over. Yu-Gi-Oh! Would be losing, he would give a speech about friendship or the heart of the cards, and then he would draw the Yu-Gi-Oh! Must Win card. And most of the time, he wouldn't even play by the rules. And then rinse and repeat that formula for 200 more episodes and 4 spin-offs, and you got yourself a successful anime. I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Was the first sign that gaming channels were gonna be a thing. Kids just love watching other people play games. Because they suck at them. Okay, enough about Japanese cartoons. If Yu-Gi-Oh! Was able to keep my hyperactive attention span engaged, then what TV shows did I think were weird, even as a kid? Keep in mind that these opinions are coming from someone who thought the Star Wars prequels were good. So, Misa take it with a grain of salt. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. To be fair, I've never seen a single episode of TMNT. From what I hear, it's a good series, but just the concept by itself was enough for my kid brain to think, this show is silly and I'm not gonna watch it. Like, come on. Ninja Turtles? That's a little weird, seeing that turtles are slow and aren't very maneuverable.
Help, I'm a turtle and I can't get up!
They're mutants? Okay, I guess that makes sense. And they're teenagers? Teenagers are mean to me. This is where I draw the line. Those are 3 adjectives that don't belong in a sentence together. And they're named after famous Renaissance artists? Why don't you just give them normal turtle names, like Sheldon. Whatever. Let's go watch a real show about Japanese people playing card games. I used to think that the Powerpuff Girls was a girly TV show, and so I never watched it. But then the show got rebooted, and everyone on the internet was saying how much they used to love the original, and all I could think was, man, if only I wasn't a sexist baby. Do you guys remember Zaboomafoo? Zaboomafoo was the show on PBS Kids where a lemur and these 2 brothers named the Krat Brothers would teach kids all about wild animals. I always thought that the 2 brothers were named the Krap Brothers, and I only just learned their real names right now when I looked up how to spell Zaboomafoo. Also, they have a website and it looks like this. Anyway, one of the episodes was all about eggs. The Krat Brothers talked all about the different kinds of eggs animals lay, and then the lemur asks,
what's it like to be in an egg?
And then one of the Krat Brothers just appears in a giant egg and says, it's pretty squishy and gooey in here. And he brought a pizza with him.
Pizza!
I watched that episode as a kid and had 2 questions. 1, how'd he get inside the egg? And 2, what laid him? The more I thought about it, the weirder I felt. This is how fetishes start, PBS. Can you believe my brother is inside this egg? Now, when I think back to movies I thought were weird as a kid, the first thing that comes to mind were those frickin' American Mouse Tale ones. They're about these mice trying to immigrate to America. Good luck doing a 2017 reboot. Also, I have to talk about all those bad Disney sequels. They're all bad. Don't tell me, oh, I thought The Little Mermaid 2 was alright. No, they're all bad. My least favorite one was The Hunchback of Notre Dame 2. I remember one time I watched both movies back to back, and just having seen the first movie, and then seeing the opening scene in the second one, I thought, what is this? This should be called The Hunchback of Notre Dame. I know those Disney sequels were just an easy way for Hollywood to make money, but think about how much more money they could have made if they just made good sequels. There was this one movie called Quest for Camelot, and as a kid, I liked this movie. It wasn't on my top 10, but it was alright. There was this one griffin who I thought looked cool and had a funny voice.
Precisely.
However, there's one part in the movie, and if you've already seen this movie, you probably know what I'm going to talk about, where a 2-headed dragon sings a song about wanting to be separated from the other dragon. There's a lot of things wrong with this song. I don't want to go too in-depth, but at one part they dress up as Cher and Elvis for some reason, except kids who watch this are too young to know or care about these people, and any adults watching this with their kids are just thinking, this is uncomfortable. Keep in mind that it takes a team of people to animate something like this. This song had to go through multiple, well-paid, professional songwriter people, and they all had to look at the scripts and go, yeah, this is definitely a good idea. The last movie that I suppressed was Charlotte's Web 2, Wilbur's Great Adventure. I don't think enough people are talking about this movie. I thought the first one was a classic story about a pig who cheats death because a nerd spider took pity on him. Also, I just want to talk about this one scene in the first movie where Wilbur found out the farmers were going to kill him, so he started crying, I don't want to die.
I don't want to die! I don't want to die!
I know this pig isn't even real, but that scene was the closest thing to turning me vegan. The sequel is exactly what you'd expect from a sequel made 30 years after the original to be. They did change the character design a lot. I guess all these celebrities are still doing plastic surgery. Look what they made Charlotte look like in the sequel. The reason I bring up this movie is because of a scene towards the end. So this one character just can't fit in with all the other farm animals. He's a black sheep. Literally, they made him a black sheep. He was doomed to be an outcast from the start. And then a fox has a musical number, attacks the farm, and then goes after the black sheep.
The other white meat.
But he doesn't kill and eat the black sheep right there, no, no, no. Instead, he kidnaps, or sheepnaps, the sheep and takes him to an abandoned house, as any fox would do. And then, I don't know if I'm interpreting this the wrong way, but watching this scene, I was picking up some creepy, non-advertiser-friendly vibes. The fox is basically telling the sheep, oh yeah, I'm gonna eat ya. I'm gonna eat ya, oh yeah. I'm gonna put you in my mouth. Just eat him already! Stop licking your lips! Look what he does with his tail, and tell me you're not picking up some sexual tension! There's even a part where the sheep started to run away, but then the fox dragged him back down. Where you think you're going, sheep boy? I'm going to be a furry. If you're weirded out by this, don't worry. I was too. And also, we're all done. Those were all the movies and shows that weren't too far suppressed down for me to tell you about. I asked a friend what movies weirded them out as a kid, and they said The Hunchback of Notre Dame. What are you talking about? That was a great movie. Get on my level, scrub. I used to watch foxes seduce their meals before they vored them. To tell you this story, I need to introduce to you a new character in my life. I try to keep some parts of my life private and off YouTube, but this story wouldn't make sense if I called this person a friend I know. We've both talked about it, and she's okay with me telling you that, guys, I have received the highest milestone a YouTuber can receive. A girlfriend! Who I will be calling for the remainder of this video, GIF. That's right, I have a girlfriend now, so you can stop asking if I'm into guys. I mean, I guess I could still technically be into guys, but please stop asking. Dang, I got muscles and a girlfriend now? Man, even I'm jealous of myself. Now, to get the elephant in the room out of the way, it's not Jaden, and it never was Jaden. And it's not the elephant either. The elephant broke up with me because I kept calling her an elephant. I know that the internet likes their ships, but let me just say this once and for all. It's not okay to ship real people that have their own lives and relationships off of YouTube. Hopefully this is all obvious and you're as grossed out as much as I am, because some of you don't seem to mind that we're all real people behind the screen, and it can be really damaging to our personal lives. So getting things back on track, one day during quarantine, me and my girlfriend were feeling lethargic and a little sad, as one does in quarantine. We had both bought Disneyland annual passes and were planning on going to the park every single day of 2020, but the timing could not have worked out more horribly, and I still don't know if I'm getting a refund. I'm not, aren't I? I had one friend tell me that something he did to cheer up was that him and his GIF drove down to the beach and had a picnic in their car, and they just relaxed and watched the sunset. And I thought that sounded fun and tranquil as shit, so me and my GIF decided that we too were also going to visit the recently opened beach and be tranquil as shit. Obviously, we were going to wear masks and stay 6 feet apart from everyone, including each other. In my head, I was imagining we would just find a secluded area and we would watch the wet, white, watery waves wash westward while wondering what weather we would want. What?
So that weekend, we packed up our beach supplies, sandwiches, and our doggies, and we started our hour-long journey to total tranquility. Floof gets very excited whenever she's wearing a leash, and in car rides, she has this energy like,
"Yes, we get to go somewhere! I wonder where we're going!"
While Gif's dog, who I will be giving the fake name of Floof 2, is more like,
"I wonder where we're going."
Our journey started out smoothly, and there were no problems for about 45 minutes. But I wouldn't be making this video if the entire trip was all smooth sailing. All of a sudden, Floof 2 starts going, which, if you own a dog, you know that means things are about to go down. Or rather, things are about to come up, and emotions and cleanliness are about to go down. So Floof 2 threw up all over my GIF's leg and on the car floor. We quickly pulled over before anyone passed out from how bad it smelled, and we used the napkins we packed to wipe everything down. We put the throw-up napkins into a sandwich bag, which now became the throw-up bag. A minor setback, to be sure, but we were still determined to relax and have a good time. But I wouldn't be making this video if the entire trip was smooth sailing, minus dog vomit. As we kept driving, we were all a little tense from the unprompted dog regurgitation, but I had a solution to ease everyone's mood. Since we were on our way to the beach, I played popular beach music like Surfin' USA. But by the time we got to California Girls, Floof 2 started going, and I mean really going, like West Coast representin' going. And Gif put her hands up like, "Oh, oh, oh, oh!" Floof 2 puked 2 times in 1 60-minute trip. That day, we learned that this California girl has unforgettable motion sickness. It's undeniable. I don't want to go into too much detail because I have to draw the details, but let's just say that Gif's hands were pretty full. I held open the throw-up bag, and Gif dumped the second round of puke from her hand into the bag. Also, we were out of napkins, because we weren't expecting to have to do this 2 times, let alone 1 times. So Gif had to drive the rest of the way with her hand held up like this. We entertained the idea of Floof 1 licking Gif's hand clean, but after some debating, we decided that doing so would be gross. After 2 dog pukes, we finally got to the beach and saw that it was very crowded and most people weren't even wearing masks. I considered throwing the throw-up bag at them, but after some debate, we decided that we still might need the throw-up bag. Fortunately, we didn't have to debate if going in was still a good idea because, as we pulled up, a deputy sheriff was closing the front gate. The beach was at full capacity.
"Do not lose hope, Biff," said my GIF, "for I shall find a closer spot within a GIF. For looking at my phone, you see, there is a beach within a mile or 3.
End of line. So we decided to try another beach, but when we got there, it was already full and blocked off. Maybe if we didn't pull over to clean up dog puke, we would have gotten there in time. But now that I'm thinking about it, it would have been impossible to relax at a beach that was at full capacity in the middle of a pandemic anyways. The good thing about Cali is that the whole edge is a beach, so we could do this all day. I looked on my phone and found another beach 15 minutes away and we headed off. I suggested that we stopped at a Walmart parking lot or something and wash our hands and recoup, but my unnamed GIF was determined to wash her puke-stained hands with the salt water of the Pacific Ocean. We pulled up to the third beach, the parking lot was empty and closed off, but there was still a clean handful of people already there. The beach wasn't even close to capacity, so we could definitely find a secluded enough area and finally relax. And clean up this dog vom like, ew, dude. If you're wondering if this beach was closed and these people were just ignoring the closed signs, we thought so too. But there are lifeguards out, so I guess the parking lot was just practicing social distancing or something, I don't know. We had to park the car pretty far away from the beach and walk the rest of the way. And as soon as we stepped out of the car, it was Floof 1's turn to wreak havoc and she dropped about half her body weight in poop onto a grass patch. I don't think this day would have been salvageable if I had to catch that in my hands. Speaking of crap, Floof 2 looked like crap and probably wanted to go home. Meanwhile, Floof 1 was still,
"Yes, I was holding that puppy in, but now we're at our destination!"
Could you just... You're being a lot right now. It wasn't the best car ride, but whatever, let's just not think about it. We're both in our flippy floppies, carrying our towels, sunscreen, and unbagged sandwiches, ready for a nice, relaxing day at the beach, only to walk up and see the worst possible thing that we could have ever seen possibly. No, it wasn't a beached whale or my ex-girlfriend. What we saw was a sign posted at the entrance that was only 3 words long. But those words were "No dogs allowed."
Floof 1 was the only thing happy in that moment, unbeknownst to her that she was half the reason our trip was ruined.
This sign won't stop me because I can't read!
So, what did we do? Well, we ate our Sammies on a bench near a beach with our bitches, and we had nothing to wash it down with since we used our water to wash our hands and we couldn't drink from the ocean like we originally planned. And then we did what we in the business call give up. We drove back home empty-handed. Thankfully, both floofs were sacked out from the day, even though they did literally nothing other than push bodily chunks out from both ends. I love both of those dogs, but I'm not bringing them back to the beach ever again. Not like they're allowed, anyways. There's not a happy ending to this story. We were both very upset. But sometimes, our most memorable trips are the ones we spend with people we love. And sometimes, life's a beach.
If you haven't read Lord of the Flies, you're probably going to have to in school one day. Let me give you an abridged version for when that time eventually comes. The Lord of the Flies is a book about a bunch of little British boys who got marooned on a deserted island, and the book tells the story about what the boys do to survive the elements, but also themselves. Within like a week on the island, the boys devolve into complete savages, covering themselves in face paint and killing a piggy. I said too much. And when I read the book in high school, I thought having the boys turn savage so quickly wasn't all that accurate. As a former young boy myself, I was insulted that William Golding thought that us little boys were so heartless. But then I remembered all the things that happened at my scout camp, Camp Geronimo, and I realized that Lord of the Flies is still inaccurate. The boys would have gone savage way faster. Listen, I'm a cautious person when I'm hanging around the guys. In PE, the other boys would be playing this game called Quarters, where you would fling quarters at people's knuckles until they bled, but I wouldn't play that game because it's dangerous and I'm a loser. Or when I was at a party and someone wanted to play the knife game to show off how good their hand-eye coordination was, I wouldn't play that game either because I needed my hands to draw. But something about being with the guys in the middle of the woods, I would live on the edge. Every summer, our troop stayed at this camp called Camp Geronimo, named after the Apache Indian who was the first person to yell Geronimo while doing a sick backflip into his pool. One time, me and a couple other boys, I don't remember who started it, but we were playing with matches, and okay, I know what you're thinking, but nothing bad happened, okay? We just accidentally lit some dried bushes on fire, and it got somewhat out of control, but it's okay, it's fine, okay? We told the scoutmaster that there was a loose fire spreading faster than we could put it out, and he got everyone in the troop to stomp on it, and we never got in trouble. What were we doing with the matches? Oh, we were just lighting them and throwing them at each other. Anyway, about 30 other scout troops attended Camp Geronimo, and we would spend a whole week sleeping in tents and earning merit badges. Most of the camp honestly felt like school, but outside. Like, when you got to the camp, you were given a schedule of classes, and for the next 7 days, you would go to those classes and learn and fill out packets and sometimes even have homework. Which probably helped us not devolve into savages. I mean, sure, the classes weren't as boring as English or geometry. Geronimo's classes were wilderness survival, kayaking, or bear self-defense. Earning a merit badge required two things. The first thing, you had to write stuff down. Name and point out the major parts of a kayak. Kayak. Explain to your counselor the hazards you are most likely to encounter while participating in kayaking activities. Bears. And the second part of the merit badge, you had to actually go out and do stuff. Capsize the kayak, swim it and the paddle to the shore, and if you don't make it, the bears will get you. I never got the kayaking merit badge. You had to be at least 12 to go to Geronimo, but you could go as an 11-year-old if a parent was coming with you. And at the time, my dad was a camp counselor. My birthday was May 14th, and Geronimo was at the end of May, so I barely made the cutoff as the youngest person going. Geronimo was a big step from spending 3 days at Cub Scout Day Camp to spending a week in the wilderness. What made it worse was I was going to be spending a whole week with all the mean older scouts and my dad. There was this one scout named Paul. When I was 11, he was 15. So naturally, he would pick on me and make fun of me. Ha ha, I get it. I'm small, so I suck. But silver lining, he got fatter. And a couple years ago, he reached out to me. And I had been doing the whole YouTube thing for a while. He was off starting his own business. And he wanted to do some business opportunity with me. And I just said, hey, do you want to do my merch? So now he works for me. So kids, if you ever have bullies, just become successful on YouTube and then hire them to sell plushies. He's actually a really good merch guy. He gets all my stuff into these retail stores. So if you see a Floof plushie at Hot Topic, you can say, thanks, Paul. Bullies really do make a difference. Anyway, self-promotion aside, my first year at Geronimo, I was a little bit on the very young side compared to everyone else. I was taking a class called Orienteering. The class taught us how to read maps and use a compass. And one day, it was time for our class to go on a scavenger hunt thing. We were given a list of places we had to go to, and we were supposed to use our compass and count our paces to get to each specific location. Then when we got to our destination, there would be a marker somewhere, and we would have to write down what that marker was. There were 10 different markers that we had to find, and the course was supposed to lead us in a circle. The leader who was in charge of our group and the compass was an older scout named Paul. It wasn't the merch guy Paul, but I think it would be funnier if it was. Our group set off to the first location. Having a compass and counting your steps isn't the most accurate way of navigation, but we weren't allowed to use Google Maps, so. When we got to the spot, we had to look around for a little bit to find the marker, but we eventually found it, and then we were off to the second location. This time, the marker was harder to find. The spot we landed on was pretty far from where the marker actually was. At the third location, we couldn't find the marker. But we did see this reflective sign on a tree, and we figured that's what the marker was supposed to be, so we wrote it down. At this point, I decided to grab my own compass and give it a try. My compass pointed in a direction that was a little bit off from Paul's direction. Not by a whole lot, but just enough. But remember, I was the little kid. Nothing I said mattered. Paul said things to me like, "Oh, you don't know how to use a compass. I bet yours is broken. I'm never going to work for you one day." And you know what? I believed him. This guy is 15 years old. Do you know how wise and experienced he is? So we kept going and struggling. We used anything we found as a marker. Some piece of trash, it's a marker. Hey, this tree has an A and an M carved into a heart. Kind of weird that it's at an all-boys camp. Do you think that it's a marker? Eventually, we all had to admit that we were completely lost. The other boys told Paul to hand over his compass, and Paul reached into his pocket, pulled out his compass, and two buzz magnets. Buzz magnets are magnets that are shaped like a bullet, and you can throw them up in the air, and they make this cool buzzing sound. They sold them at the camp store, so that's why Paul had them. And everyone immediately figured out why we were lost. For those of you who don't know how compasses and magnets work, I don't know either. I think it has something to do with them coming from outer space. A compass is supposed to point to the magnetic North Pole, and a magnet will mess up the direction a compass is supposed to point in. Paul's compass wasn't pointing to his pants the whole time. We would have been suspicious if that had happened. But because his compass was right next to a magnet, it got uncalibrated. And then we all got lost in the woods and died. And that's why I don't have an orienteering merit badge. I was upset because my compass probably wasn't broken, but I didn't stand up for myself. Because I don't do that. I have more Camp Geronimo stories, like the time me and my friend threw a Ziploc bag full of water at the older kids' lean-to, and then I ran away so fast that I threw up. But I already did a video about that, and it's 5 years old, and it's very bad, and you're not allowed to watch it. So the moral of this video is, just because you're young doesn't mean you're stupid, but it does mean you make bad videos on YouTube. Also, check your pockets before going orienteering. Going orienteering. Sounds like a tongue twister. Going orienteering. Going orienteering. Going orienteering. Recently, I read the worst YouTube comment ever, and I can't stop thinking about it. This comment lives in my head completely rent-free. It lives in its own private penthouse. The comment was concerning my upload schedule, and it was, "If anime studios can make an episode of anime in 1 week, then these YouTubers can make a video in a month." Initially, I reacted like, "You think that's how this works? You think anime studios post an episode and go, 'Great work, team! Well, time to make the next episode this week. Hope none of you have any plans!'" I know the working conditions in Japan are bad, but sheesh! I guess all the animators are just slacking off between seasons then, huh? And as I thought about it more, I realized, I can't get too mad. This person is just uneducated about the animation industry and is probably a minor. And then I thought, hey, I know a bit about animation behind the scenes. Maybe I could talk about being an artist and educate people on the animation pipeline. So that way, I won't get any more uneducated comments. For this video, when I say artist, I'm going to be talking about the Google definition of an artist. Noun, a person who produces paintings or drawings as a profession or hobby. You know, the pen and paper artists. I'm not really going to be talking about artists who make music or birthday cakes or take black and white photos of sunsets because I want to talk about cartoons. I make cartoons. Now, it should come to no surprise that I'm pro-artist. Well, not a pro artist. Are you kidding? I know my skill level. I still can't draw fingers. What I'm saying is I will support anyone who wants to make art. If you're making art as a hobby, then that's a really great creative outlet, and having something physical as an end result is incredibly rewarding. But if you want to turn making art into a full-time job, you might want to sit down and consider a few things. Like, are you sure you don't want to go to law school? The biggest challenge all artists face is they have to eat food to survive. And in this capitalist society, food costs money. So artists are challenged to somehow take being good at making shapes and turn that into money. I know of 4 ways an artist can make a living. The first way is to be so good at art that people will pay money to hang it up in their house. The second option is to make caricature drawings at beaches and tourist traps. The third option is to sell your plasma. And the fourth option, which is the most common option, is to make drawings that people will pay you to make. And do a little bit of option 3 on the side. Some artists will take commissions, which is basically an artist going, "Hey, I'll draw whatever you want, asterisk, for $100. And people will go, "What the f-? Art should be free! I was gonna give you so much exposure to my 50 Twitter followers!" Or people will go, "I want you to draw this cute animal character I made, and while at first your price might seem a bit high to the uneducated, I understand that art is a time-consuming process and you need to eat too. So here's a crisp $100. But another somewhat more stable idea is that artists will get jobs at studios or work for a YouTuber, and we'll be like, "Hey, we'll give you money if you draw specifically what we want, and if we don't like your art, we'll make sure to communicate clearly what we would like changed and work as a team to do the best we can. Or you're fired!" And that leads us into animation. An important thing to remember for animation is that drawings equal time plus money. Exactly how much time? Well, to answer that one commenter's question, no, an anime studio does not make an episode of anime in 1 week. I think. South Park is what making an episode in a week looks like. And truthfully, that's very impressive. I take months trying to figure out what the heck I'm even going to talk about. Making a single episode of a cartoon from scratch takes about 2 years. Don't believe me? Well, let's see what Yakko from the 2020 Animaniacs has to say in the very first episode. At least, we still think there's a President Trump. You see, the writers are writing this in 2018. Now that doesn't mean it took 26 years to make the first season of the Animaniacs. There's a lot of moving parts that happen when producing an animated TV series. For starters, the whole season of the show gets made at the same time. While the writers are writing episode 12, the storyboard team is boarding episode 3, and the design team is designing the bowling shoes that are going to be worn in episode 6. And it's someone's entire job to make sure that everyone's doing their job. This is called the animation pipeline. And there's so many other departments that I could honestly make a whole other video about this pipeline. If you're interested, I'll do it. But just know that it takes roughly 2 years to make a season of a cartoon show. And that's why when shows reference memes, they're extremely outdated. You know, like a boss! It's beautiful, isn't it? This exterior nighttime city skyline background. This background was drawn by one of my background artists, Annie Loomis, and it took 7 hours to make. And it was used specifically for this clip. If it wasn't for the Cats movie, I would have thought Hollywood knew what they were doing too. It lasted for 4 seconds. 7 hours of work, 4 seconds of content. So before we continue, I'm going to make you all sit and appreciate this background for another 4 seconds so I can double the value of this background. Backgrounds can be a time-consuming process, and the whole purpose of them is to be in the back of the ground. They're not even the focus. So storyboarders will sketch out a scene to set the staging through layout, posing, and character expression. And during this phase, I'm trying to find places where I can reuse backgrounds or take pieces of other backgrounds and Frankenstein monster them together to make an entirely new background. Like how I used the city background to be outside this window. Or how I took the buildings from this background, the bushes from this background, and the bench from this background and made an entirely new background. And hopefully, none of you noticed. Am I being cheap? Or cutting corners? Absolutely. But that's the point. That gives another background artist more time to make something else, like this James-themed city skyline. Instead of having to draw 20 different backgrounds of a bedroom, we already have a bedroom. Let's just do something else, please. It's not being lazy. It's getting the most use, the most mileage out of your hard work. I see this next story pop up on Twitter about every month, and it makes me want to stab my eyes out. If you look at this scene from The Jungle Book and this scene from Winnie the Pooh, these two similarly proportioned boys are eerily moving in the exact same way. Wait, was this plagiarized? Did someone from Winnie the Pooh plagiarize The Jungle Book? No. Remember what I said about drawings equal time plus money? Well, back in the old days of animation, before fancy graphics cards and floppy disks, animation frames had to be physically painted onto floppy, transparent sheets called cells. So animated movies were essentially a really long flipbook with over 100,000 hand-drawn painted pages. Back then, drawings equaled even more time and even more money. This whole sequence had to not only be drawn 24 times a second, but it also had to have the correct timing to look like a little boy was jumping on rocks. Just because you drew 24 Mowglis doesn't mean they're gonna look good when you play the frames together. So if you're making a cartoon movie in the 70s, and you need a scene where a young boy character is just being a dude and throwing rocks, and you need a really climactic fight scene, are you gonna spend the time and money drawing another boy throwing another rock when someone else already did that 10 years ago? Or are you gonna reuse the animation the studio already made, and then have more time and budget to make an even epicker fight scene? If these movies were from two different studios, then yes, that would be a completely different story. But Disney owns this movement of our boy Mowgli, so they're allowed to use that movement on our boy Chris. Turning your art into a full-time job is very difficult. I'm extremely lucky to not only have this opportunity, but to be able to build an amazing team of talented artists to create these cartoons and share them with you. And because of you watching these videos and supporting me, I'm able to reinvest money into the team so we can make better quality content and I can support more artists. It's a win-win symbiotic thing we got going on. So if you ever wanted to get into the art industry, good luck, get drawing, and start putting that portfolio together. One time, me and a group of buddies were driving through Texas, and we passed a building that looked like the Whataburger corporate office. Just to be sure, I checked my phone and discovered, yeah, we did just drive past the Whataburger corporate office. But what I found interesting was that the building had hundreds of one-star reviews. After some investigation, I found that these reviews weren't coming from the Whataburger corporate staff. No, these reviews were from once loyal customers who in one way or another had a negative experience at a Whataburger and were gonna take this issue to the top! Reading people's wordy laments about their terrible fast food experiences has become a hobby of mine. And it's not just Whataburger. Every fast food corporate office has hundreds of one-star reviews. These people have been wronged by a billion-dollar company, and the only way they can get back at them is calling them stupid. The team at blah 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 have no intelligence whatsoever. I ordered three large lemonades, and all three spilled in the inside of my car because the cup holder was way too flimsy. I told the manager named Josh, and all he said he could do was say he's sorry. Sorry isn't going to clean up the mess caused by their stupidity! This guy spilled three lemonades all over his car, and instead of going, "Ah, I'm so stupid," he went, "Ah, Josh is stupid." This just goes to show that you could do your job perfectly and still have angry customers. Also, what did you expect Josh to do? Hey, I just spilled all that lemonade you gave me in that cup holder. Oh my goodness, how could I be so stupid? I forgot to turn off spill mode. Bring your car out back and I'll get a straw and then I'll suck it dry.
No need to thank me. That's what fast food employees are for.
I can't talk about fast food without bringing up a small local sandwich shop in my area. So here are some of my favorite one-star Sua Boy reviews. We went to the location in blah blah blah. We had 30 minutes to close. I know, sucks, but there was a huge regional wrestling match and there were some starving boys. I walked in and let them know we had 20 sandwiches to order. We didn't have crazy expectations. Substituting meat, forget tomatoes if you're out. We don't need toasted, let's just feed these boys. Nine sandwiches in, the sweetest girl who was making our food said her manager said, "Shut it down," and they're not making the rest of the order. The manager had the employee in tears, and nine boys didn't get food. I was mind blown. We offered big tips, gave free oil changes to employees working hard to make money. I run a mechanic shop and stay late for customer a lot. We didn't have crazy expectations. We just wanted a whole catering order 30 minutes before close. I know some people are going to be thinking, you're a business that's still open, so you have to do what the customer says. But I want those same people to ask their mother to make them 20 sandwiches at 9:30 p.m. and let me know what she says. And if those 9 boys were still upset, they should have just suplexed the manager into a table and then made the cold cut combo themselves. I placed an order online for 2 footlongs. I walked in to pick up my order, and I was thankful I didn't leave a tip. I received 1 footlong, but ordered 2. It's very clear on the receipt that was attached to the package. I showed it to the woman working behind the counter, and she laughed and said, "Oh, I didn't see that. Let me get that for you." Not sure why she missed that. Has never happened to me before. Is she on something, or does she not know how to read English? I had to stand there and wait for her to make the other foot long, and then this person continues to write a whole 500-word manifesto. Are they on drugs? Can they read English? Jeez. Do you think this reviewer is going to tell their grandkids about this story? And then I had to stand next to the sneeze guard for 2 minutes. Okay, Grandma, can we go? And they forgot the mayo! There are a whole bunch of lengthy reviews just like this. And for these types of reviews, I, like, start thinking about these people psychologically. I feel like these people either have something else going on or nothing else going on. I'm sorry that your lunch was ruined, but if this is the biggest problem in your life, you're doing all right. And maybe this wouldn't have happened if you left a tip. I went to the location at blah, blah, blah. The guy Frank there needs to take some customer service classes. He is not friendly, and when I told him he should be more friendly to his customers, he told me to go ahead and call whoever I wanted to complain. Frank, I love you. You don't need to take customer service classes. You need to be teaching them. IDK, who was working at around 9:45 on May 17th, but somebody needs to give them a hug. I pull up to the window to pay, and there was 3 girls standing there doing nothing. One of them mumbled my total and stuck out her hand. I gave her my card, and she did her thing. Then she handed me a crumpled mess of a bag and 2 drinks with, like, 0 ice. No have a nice night, no thanks for stopping in, not even a hello. IDK, if all 3 of those girls lives together and somebody ran over their dog or something, but all 3 of them looked like they absolutely hated being there, and me ordering my meal was the biggest inconvenience they could have experienced. I feel so bad for these workers, they need a hug, but also screw them 1 star. I can't believe this McDonald's took my review down, but that's okay, I will recite it. They had no barbecue sauce for their nuggets the whole Memorial Day weekend. For all you barbecue sauce lovers out there, when you went to this location on any of those days and asked for barbecue sauce and you were told they didn't have any more, you must have felt crushed like I did. Like, what was the point of ordering nuggets and finding out they didn't have barbecue sauce afterwards? Why didn't they disclose that fact before ordering the nuggets and paying for it? I'll tell you why. Because they wanted to take advantage of us, just to get that sale. What, the employees do take the barbecue sauce to their homes to use for their own Memorial Day weekend barbecues? This is one memorable, unfavorable moment that will be remembered for years to come. You know, there are many who are barbecue sauce lovers out there that went through the same feeling I did when I ordered 3 20-piece nuggets just to find out afterwards they didn't have any barbecue sauce. Like, if you agree. I don't want to jump to any conclusions, but do you think they're out of barbecue sauce because the world's number one barbecue sauce lover keeps ordering there? Going through all the trouble to write a review and then recite the review again, all because they're out of barbecue sauce, seems like a lot, but 60 nuggets with no sauce on a national holiday is a tragedy, I'll give you that. I love that this guy didn't even consider that they were just out of sauce and instead went full conspiracy mode, thinking the employees were hoarding the sauce for their own barbecue. You gotta have barbecue sauce for your barbecue. It's in the name. I'm not going to act like every fast food restaurant is in the right all the time, because I've had my fair share of terrible fast food experiences too. I once ordered a burger from Sonic, and they gave me the burger with no meat. And I went, dang, well, that's how my day is gonna go, I guess. I didn't write a lengthy review to hopefully be seen by someone at corporate. I don't know. I, like, I got other problems. If reading these reviews has taught you anything, it's that these fast food workers have to deal with all sorts of customers going through all sorts of problems. So please be the customer who shows a little compassion. They are handling your food after all. Leave a like if you agree. My child works for Whataburger, hasn't been paid since December 2nd. Today is 1-4 and still no paychecks. We've been told lies saying paycheck is coming to the store, then FedEx is delivering it, and still nothing. He's only 18, so I feel like they're trying to get over on him. Not to mention the shift manager Liz is having an affair with some of the employees. Yo, what? A burger? Thank you all for watching the video. If you enjoyed it, then I highly recommend reading some of these corporate office fast food reviews yourself. They're a real treat to read. Just some of the passion that these people have needs to be studied. Obviously, not everyone who leaves a one-star review is an obnoxious Karen, but the ones who go out of their way to review a corporate office are some of my favorites. Thanks again for watching, and wear your seatbelt.
Hey man, have you ever noticed that we wear the exact same clothes every day? We don't wear any clothes. What if we're both just a cartoon character, and that's why our clothing's the same? That's impossible. Cartoon characters' mouths move. We just open our mouths and words start coming out.
Hey guys, did you see my brand new Rolex? Are you jealous?
Doesn't your phone tell the time? Maybe he never noticed that his phone has a clock in it.
No one buys a Rolex to tell the time. I can't even read this. People buy Rolexes to indirectly tell everyone how much money we can throw away on useless objects. Hey, look what my watch can do. Ring, ring.
Hello?
You'll never believe what Brian just bought.
What'd he buy?
A watch.
Really?
What a nerd.
Oh, Brian.
I'm the kind of person who doesn't really care about my outward appearance. A lot of times in high school, we talk about having a healthy self-image of ourselves, and teachers would say stuff like, "Don't listen to the people who call you ugly. You're beautiful." And all I could think was, there's people saying I'm ugly? For the most part, I haven't really tried to even learn anything about fashion. Most of the time when I get dressed in the morning, I wear just whatever's the cleanest. Like, I don't even know my pant size because I wear basketball shorts all the time. I think I'm a medium. My parents taught me the value of hard work by making me pay for all my clothes, and I am 100% on board with that parenting technique. I think even the super, super rich parents should still make their kids buy their own clothes. Because if you just buy your child anything they want, then they're going to turn into a-holes who just expect everything without having to work hard. Those are the types of kids who grow up to flex all their money on people and who leave their basketball cards all over the cramped dorm. And also, buying your own clothes makes you think harder about what you're going to spend your precious dollars on. You don't want to waste your money, so you have to pick clothes you really like.
Except my mom told me I couldn't buy anything with skulls on them. She said they were too edgy. And you know what? Fair enough, Mom. Looking back, I'm glad I skipped that emo edgy phase. But why didn't you let me express my true self, Mom?
Thank you for not letting me do that.
In the 7th grade, I went through an I need to look cool phase. And one time, I saved up quite a bit of money, so me and my mom went on a shopping spree at Kohl's. Hashtag not sponsored. I was going to impress everyone. I was going to look so cool with my brand new 2 pairs of jeans. I'll get this normal blue pair, and then the exact same pair, just in case I spill ketchup on the first pair. That's another reason why I'm pro have your kids pay for their own clothes. So that way they learn how expensive clothes shopping is. Seriously, 2 pairs of jeans was $70. Do you know how many Pokemon cards I could have bought? Probably enough to make my own pair of PokePants. And that's when I learned about the magical land of Goodwill. At Goodwill, you could buy mediocre, questionably stained-looking jeans for a fourth of the price of Kohl's. And since I had to buy all my clothes and I was unemployed, I was at Goodwill every other Saturday for that half-off deal. You're at Goodwill and everything's half-off. That's like a double sale, people. Here's the thing. Typically, clothes stores have a certain style they specialize in. Tilly's, you know you're gonna get that hip LA-style clothes. At Old Navy, you know you're gonna get that white boy Ohio look. And H&M, you know you're gonna get demonetized. But when you step inside your local Goodwill, you don't know what you're getting. You get every style of clothing all in one place. I got my favorite t-shirt from Goodwill. I even wore it to this panel at VidCon.
You know, the panel where I didn't even talk into the microphone, so you couldn't hear half the words I said.
Ah, but James, I don't want to wear clothes that have already been worn by other people. They're gross. Ugh, cuties and herpes.
Yeah, no, that's true. You don't know who else has worn your clothing.
But then again, you could be wearing something that was also worn by the Odd Ones Out.
Yeah, that's right. I donate my clothes to Goodwill. Reduce, reuse, recycle, baby.
Why would someone make a pair of pants out of Pokemon cards?
And give it away!
I'm not saying don't buy expensive clothing. Buy whatever you want to buy and can't afford.
If there's two shirts, one is $40 and one is $5, and you really, really like the $40 shirt and hate the $5 one, you should get the $40 shirt because you'll end up wearing it more often, so you get more use out of it.
In economics, there's a term used to measure how much happiness a product will give you, and it's called utils.
Sometimes buying more expensive things will give you more utils of happiness, so it's worth it to buy expensive clothing. But for me, I get way more utils buying a shirt for $5.
You cannot put a price on all the oodles and oodles of utils I get for wearing a shirt I like for $5.
You can wear your Supremes and your Abercrombos or whatever all you want. I just don't think it makes a lot of sense spending that much money on a white t-shirt with an ironed-on logo. There's no material in that shirt that makes it as expensive as it is.
Oh, never mind.
What you're really doing is paying for the name brand. So you might as well staple two $20 bills to your shirt and write in Sharpie, "Look, everyone, I got $40. But again, if you like the design of a white shirt and a red rectangle, then you be happy wearing it. I'm not telling you what to wear. But I will tell you this. Don't judge someone based on their clothing. That's like the most shallow thing a person can do. Even if someone is wearing old hand-me-downs or a really expensive name-brand t-shirt, don't treat people differently because of their clothing. There's a certain YouTuber going around, I'm not going to say any names, but I will draw pictures, who's teaching kids that their value as a person is correlated to the amount of money they spend on clothing. Don't do that. Okay, real talk over now. School uniforms! People who support school uniforms say that uniforms are better because then the students don't have to think about what they're going to wear the next day because everyone has to wear the same outfit. But like, I already don't think about what I'm wearing. That's probably why I'm naked right now. Okay, that's not entirely true. I'm not just going to walk outside wearing a pink poncho. I have standards. I just buy all the cheap clothing I think looks nice. In high school, I mostly wore solid color V-neck t-shirts, and one time a kid on the very last day of school told me, "James, you always wear solid color V-neck t-shirts. You're like a cartoon character."
That's what I'm going for. I've always wanted to be a cartoon. I don't think you realize how much I love cartoons.
One time I bought those shoes with the really fat tongues. I thought they looked cool, but they certainly didn't feel cool. They didn't have any support for my soul. I couldn't go running in them,